Everybody, we are live.
You know, normally we save all of the chit chat, and I'm almost being literal that we save all the chit chat for once we're live, but we had a little bit of special time just for the three of us this week. So thank you for the live people for being patient. All right.
That sounds like a very different kind of thing.
As I said it, I realized I wanted it back, but I was just going to plow forward. Also, not helping with
this
that
particular
phrasing.
This is a very special episode of ATP.
I guess I don't know what that is. They don't have very special episodes anymore. It's just a thing they probably hear in memes or whatever. But
that's true.
We're exposed to it legitimately.
I was even
ironically,
like,
they would tell us it was a very special episode.
Casey, yep. Did you get I feel like we are almost a little bit too young for that. Like, I know what they are, but I don't think I ever even saw one, or maybe I only saw.
I might have been a little bit before your time.
Yeah,
I mean, my memory is such trash that I don't remember for certainty, but I believe I've seen those sorts of things, and typically they were very serious, right? Occasionally they were like fun crossovers, but I thought they were
typically
fun.
It's always
serious.
Yeah, it's like we have to talk about drugs or something.
Yeah, like Arnold gets like sexually abused by one of his teachers on Different Strokes, like that kind of episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, yeah, let's talk actually, about teen pregnancy. Like, there's all this. It was always something like negative or, you know, serious.
Yeah, and someone with far too many consonants in their name in the chat said, "I remember a very special episode of Family Ties." That's exactly what I was thinking of. Actually, couldn't tell you what it was about, but I was thinking specifically of Family Ties. So yeah, I think that's what it's about. All right, I would like to do some quasi-follow-up, but I'm going to do it in the pre-show, which I know is in violation of follow-up copyright 2011 John Siracusa. For spring break last week, we went on a tour of Southwest Virginia, which was a lot of fun, despite there being very little in Southwest Virginia. But we found what there was to do and did it.
Now we're going to hear from all four people who live there.
Yeah, right. And I say that as someone who went to school in Southwest Virginia. But anyways, what we did was we started the trip by going down to Blacksburg, which is way in the butt of Virginia, way, way, way Southwest Virginia, about 3.5 hours from where I live. That's where, like I said, I went to school at Virginia Tech, showed the kids around. Aaron had been there a couple times, but the kids hadn't. Stayed a night. And actually, I wasn't planning on talking about this, but it occurred to me in the hotel in Blacksburg, the hotel room had the unthinkable within it. And it made me exceedingly happy. What do you think was in that hotel room?
Ethernet port.
Correct. Nailed it. There, not only was there an Ethernet jack, but it was connected and worked, which was incredible. So I was very, very happy using my little Unified Travel Router to connect to the Ethernet. But anyways, that's not actually why I'm bringing this up. I'm bringing this up because there's a trail, like a hike, about half an hour outside of Blacksburg, which I had heard about so many times when I was in school that, oh, you know, we're going to go hike the Cascades. We're going to go do the Cascades, the Cascades, Cascades, Cascades. And I'd never actually done it when I was down there. But the kids and Aaron and me, we all did some hikes a couple of spring breaks ago in the Shenandoah National Park. Really enjoyed that. And so during this three-night vacation slash tour, we did a trio of hikes as well. And the biggest one was this first one at the Cascades Trail. And you basically drive from nowhere to further nowhere and then drive through a neighborhood and spontaneously just come out at like a parking situation and like a little hut with a bathroom. And then you start on this hike that goes to these really beautiful waterfalls. And the waterfalls, you know, have the water cascading down them. I presume that's the genesis of the name, right? Well, anyways, on the way out of the hike, you know, we did the two miles out, 2 miles back. Kids were absolute troopers, you know, did a great job. And then I was going to get in the car and I was wearing my beloved workout shorts and one of my ATP exercise t-shirts, which we're sort of, but not really going to talk about in a second. And what do I hear as I'm getting in Aaron's Volvo for the second time in the last, whatever it is, 7 months, I hear clunk, 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 crash. Great.
I just want to pause here for a second and ask the longtime ATP listeners, how long into that story did you figure out that Casey was going to tell us that he dropped his phone? That is a great measurement, because obviously Marco and I are cheating because we see the show notes and we know where he's going with this. But I'm just curious for the people listening. How you're listening, Casey's winding up. He's got a big wind up on his pitches. He's going along. When did you figure out, oh, Casey dropped his phone again, didn't he?
I think as soon as I said hike is probably when, when
was it hike? Was it just like going on vacation? Was it middle of nowhere?
Oh, it's so true. I want to be so mad at you, but I you're absolutely correct. But yes, so at the end of the hike, I'm getting back in the car and I hear thunk, thunk, crash. And sure enough, my phone had fallen out of my workout shorts, which has happened from these same shorts once before. You'd think I would have learned, but no, I didn't.
You got some new shorts with bigger pockets, got pockets with zippers, seriously. Something, anything. Well,
these shorts actually do have zippers, but the zipper broke, unfortunately. And so here we are. Again, this is a problem of my own creation, but anyways, I looked down, and sure enough, the pop socket had yeeted itself halfway across the parking lot.
Are we allowed to say yeet?
Yes.
We're not too old to say that?
Oh, no, we are, but
I think that's actually your generation.
No.
It is?
No, no.
Yeah, isn't that a millennial thing? Yeet?
No.
I don't think so. I think it's
absolutely
Z or much
younger. All right.
Well, anyway, I say you can say it. I declare that you can say it.
Oh, thanks, Dad.
It's out of style now, so
exactly.
It's suitably unfashionable for you.
Exactly.
Well, and definitely, I mean, it's definitely out of style now that we're using it.
Precisely right.
That's how you can tell, yeah.
So the pop socket had launched itself across the parking lot, and sure enough, my phone was face down, and it was on blacktop cement, whatever it was. And I think to myself, oh, all right, it's been about 6 months. That's probably about due for me to shatter the phone. And I picked it up, and it was pristine. It was perfectly fine. What? This is the second time this has fallen from a Volvo XC90 out of my pocket onto the pavement, face down. Both times, it has been pristine.
Is there a case on it or no?
No case.
No case.
I think now I'm going to absolutely jinx myself, so let me do a little Foley work and knock on wood. I think I can declare Ceramic Shield 2 the real deal. And so I went back to the keynote from September to see who was introducing it and what they said, and it was Kyan Drance. And she said very little about it, but she did say there's three times better scratch resistance, and that they like infused ceramic in a different way and different like molecular or chemical bonds or whatever. But the only real like marketing phrase was three times better scratch resistance. I got to tell you, so far, I think I might have noticed like a little baby scratch, maybe, which by now every prior phone I've had has been freaking ruined. That's why I went to the screen protectors for right. the last phone, which I was going through like water, because I was constantly scratching up my phones, the face of my phones, the screen of my phones. There's maybe one itty bitty scratch, and it has fallen from like waist height onto pavement, face down twice, hasn't shattered yet. I have to say, I'm very impressed. As much as I've been pissing and moaning about the fragility of the screens up until now, in the 17 Pro, it's good stuff. I'm very impressed.
Well, right. I would strongly recommend, Casey, that you not get the foldable iPhone.
I don't want to belabor this pre-show, but I've thought a lot about what I'm going to do with that. And I think this is classic Casey. I don't think I want a foldable phone because I think that's too much. And I don't think I fully acknowledge this classic. Mm-hmm.
What do you think, John? 100%. 1 week after it's released?
No. Well, hold on.
I'm just saying
that
the screen on that one is not going to be as durable.
No, it will not.
As this one.
But no,
I guess it's good that he can close it when it's closed. Like the screen won't be. There'll be the outer screen. Anyway, it doesn't seem like it's the product for you is what I'm saying.
Yeah, you can break three screens at once.
Right, I can shatter all the screens.
New frontiers in screen breaking.
No, but I've been thinking about, like, I think for me, I'm not in love with spending $2,000 on a phone or whatever it'll end up being. I'm not in love with, I don't think I want or need a foldable in my life, which again, classic Casey, I recognize that. But most importantly, I don't think I want to drop any of the three camera situations on my current phone. And everyone seems to think it'll be one or two lenses on the foldable phone. And so I've been wondering, what do I do? And I think what I do is, assuming they all come out at the same time, which is also under debate, I think I do try a foldable phone, because if nothing else, I should do it for the show. And then maybe I'm that jerk that returns it within 2 weeks, or you know, it returns it on day 13 after having tried it, because I decide, you know, it's really not for me. But I think I got to try it.
What's your position on having test devices for your life as an iOS developer?
I mean,
Marco, yeah, with the ready reason to buy.
I was going to say, I see the loophole building as we speak. I mean, that is fair. And maybe that is the rightest answer, is I use a carry phone that is, you know, the 18 Pro or what have you. And I have the foldable as the test device. I don't know, because that's an interesting point.
The reason I ask is that one of the excuses I've always used over the years is that when there is a like reasonably new and different form factor of a device, I feel like I should probably have one as an iOS developer. Not only, you know, just to have like extra devices to like put betas on and stuff, but also like if it's a different form factor, I should know how that handles. I should know how it feels in the hand. Where should controls be? How big should controls be? How should things be laid out? And, you know, and sometimes you can just guess, like when the phone gets a little bit bigger or a little bit smaller, you know, or, you know, the Apple Watch gets a little bit bigger. Like, if things are generally the same other than a small size difference, that doesn't usually require, like, I don't have every single iPhone model. I have a few. But when something is as different as, like, going from iPhone to iPad, then that, I think, you know, you should probably have an iPad if your app runs on iPad. I think going from regular iPhones to the folding iPhone, that's pretty different physically, and there might also be very different software features. And yes, we will have a simulator that you can see how your app is laid out in the simulator. You can, you know, deal with probably what, you know, whatever the multitasking system ends up being. Like, I'm sure you can simulate all that, but I don't think that's going to replace the experience of actually handling it in terms of like knowing how your app should look and work on that device. I think any iOS developer responsible for design and layout and controls who has any, you know, budget ability to do this is probably going to want to get, probably going to want to have an iPhone Fold of their own, even if it's not their daily carry phone. It's probably a good idea to have it and maybe live with it for like a week or two or something, just so you can figure out how it handles and design your app accordingly. Because that is going to be a pretty different experience for apps if the rumors are at all true.
Yeah, I agree, and we'll see if I can justify it, much less, you know, selling it to the rest of the family. But we'll see. But anyway, thank you for indulging me. And yeah, Ceramic Shield 2, the real deal. All right, we have some important breaking news. The ATP store is back, baby. You can go to atp.fm/store, where John will proceed to take us on a nickel tour of all the different things that he has in store for you.
Yes, this is, in fact, the WWDC 2026 store. Seems like the WWDC store comes earlier every year, but really it's always around this time. We try to get people their items in time to attend WWDC, which is a thing that is rare these days because it doesn't hold a lot of people and most people don't get to go. But, you know, that's the theory, so that's why it's so early, FYI. So get your orders in now. Here's what we've got. The first product is actually four products. It's the opposite of the iPhone intro. And I'll explain why. So this is, it's a t-shirt, and it's ATP Neo, and these are shirts inspired by the MacBook Neo, because they come in the color combinations that the MacBook Neo comes in. They're called ATP Neo Indigo, Blush, Citrus, and Silver. Here's the concept. The shirt should be more or less the color of, like, the body of the Neo, and the logo, it's just the monochrome ATP logo, should be the color of the keyboard. And as you know, the keyboards on all the MacBook Neos are color matched to the device. So even though when you look at like the pink one and like the yellowy citrus one, you're like, oh, they both have white keyboards. They don't. The pink one has like a lightly pinkish keyboard, and the citrus one has like a lightly yellow keyboard, and it's the same for all of them. The keyboards are not the same color on these devices. So the logo is not the same color on these shirts. And that's why they have to be four separate shirts, because the way Cotton Bureau does it, if you have a different ink color, that's a different shirt, because, you know, you're printing a different thing on it. So, and the other thing is, to get shirts that are colored, like the MacBook Neo, we unfortunately don't have the clout to say, make me a shirt that matches this color. No, we just have to look at every shirt that's available for us to, you know, order blanks of, and then find a company that makes a shirt in a color that's close to the laptop color. And that's what we've done. And we've picked out four shirt colors here. I think the silver one is the farthest off because it's a little bit too dark. But we did the best we could because we got all four shirts from the same company, the same like shirt model or whatever. And that means that there's only t-shirts. So even though we've been rolling at all sorts of varieties or whatever, we could only get these colors from this one specific brand in t-shirt. So it's just t-shirts. Indigo, blush, citrus, and silver with an ATP logo on it, color match to the thing. The pictures don't really do it justice. We're trying to make it look subtle like the keyboards do on the MacBook Neo. But anyway, there's four shirts. And unfortunately, because there's four, there's like a minimum threshold before they'll print each one. So I hope enough people will buy each one of the colors that they actually get printed. If they don't, oh well, lesson learned. That's ATP Neo, our tribute to the MacBook Neo, a great new Mac that everybody loves. And moving on to a very old Mac that nobody loves except for me, we have the Mac Pro Memorial shirt. We had the products for the store all set to go before they killed the Mac Pro, and so we kind of had to scramble on this one. And what you get is exactly what you would expect. In hindsight, it is, I don't know, foreshadowing that the Mac Pro Believe shirt also looked a little bit like a tombstone. Because now what we've done is take the Mac Pro Believe shirt, and instead of saying Believe underneath that picture of the Mac Pro, now we've just got birth year to death year, 2019 to 2026.
Shout out to, I forget the listener's name, who made a mock-up that said Bereave.
Yep. Yep, that's a good one too, but it requires you to know the other shirt, and honestly, it's not really bereaving because they really needed to be canned. But anyway, it's just, you know, the year range. And some people thought it should have the year like of the original Mac Pro, but no, it's the thing that's pictured on the shirt. The thing that's pictured on the shirt was introduced in 2019 and killed in 2026. And yes, I have already ordered one of these to go to John Turnus. I hope he feels bad when he gets it.
That's incredible. And we are under the impression that he did receive the original Believe shirt.
He sure
right?
did.
I know for mm-hmm. sure that he did.
All right, and that one, again, that's two shirts because the darker color shirts have light ink and vice versa. So it's Mac Pro Memorial. Mac Pro Memorial Dark, again, ink color thing. Then we have two shirts that probably should have been in the last sale, but I don't know, maybe it would have been too much. But anyway, last sale we did ATP T568A and T568B, our Ethernet wiring standard shirts, where we replaced the Apple six-color stripes and the ATP logo with the colors of the conductors in an Ethernet cable according to the T568A and B standards. Well, this time we have two more shirts, T568A and B, but they're crossover cables. And you can we put links on the store page. You can go to like the Wikipedia page. I'm pretty sure I got these right. I quadruple checked like a million times and did so many Google searches. Here's what Wikipedia says. Here's what these things say. I'm pretty sure that these are the correct wiring arrangements for a gigabit, not 100 or 10, a gigabit crossover cable, which isn't really a thing I think you need anymore because on all the ports AutoSense and Switch or whatever. But anyway, crossover cables are still a thing that exists. And so now the colored stripes, the top half has like what one end of the connector cable should be, pins 1 through 8. And the bottom half has what the other half should be. And yes, there are different crossover cables for T568A and B. So we have the two crossover shirts. And they're really pushing the limits. Like last time we have like ugly shirts, like because the Ethernet wiring colors are not particularly attractive. And now they're even less attractive because the colors are all mixed up. But you nerds love it. You love those networking nerds want to have the most obscure shirt that someone is sure to ask you about. And then you get to explain about Ethernet wiring standards. Then we have the M5 Pro and Mac shirts, because since our last sale, those two chips came out. Those chips are good. They deserve shirts. There are no chip designs in the back because we haven't done that in a while. But we've got M5 Pro and M5 Max in all the usual shapes and sizes. We do like to bring back one old shirt in every sale. And this time we're bringing back a shirt that we sold a couple of times that has been very popular. ATP Pixels is back. This is the one with the six-color ATP logo on it, but it's drawn in pixels, which is quite a printing challenge. I guess people who bought this shirt a while ago know how well it held up, but I have one as well. I think it came out really good. It looks really good. It's chunky. As the description said, it's non-retina. You can see the pixels. It's chunky pixels. It's the ATP logo in a bunch of chunky pixels. Extremely difficult to manufacture. It seemed to come out good last time. Fingers crossed for this time. And then, of course, we have our traditional ATP shirt. Our traditional ATP zip hoodie. We got the ATP polo because it's short sleeve weather. And we have the ATP hat. That is our WWDC 2026 sale. If anybody orders a Mac Pro Memorial shirt and happens to go to WWDC and gets it in time and can wear it there, make sure you stare Apple executives straight in the eye and look as sad as you possibly can, and then just point to your shirt. That's what we want. We want them to just feel terrible.
Oh, my word. Now, if you wanted to save a little bit of money on your order, John, how do you go about doing that?
ATP members get 15% off everything in the store. If you go to your member page, which is linked at the top of the store page, you will get a code. Remember that if you are logged in to ATP.fm, just by logging in through your account and you are an ATP member, then all the links that you click on should automatically autofill your discount code. But if it doesn't do that, you can always go to your member page and copy and paste it the old-fashioned way. And based on how much these shirts cost, and yes, I know they're tremendously expensive, especially if you're in Europe, we apologize for that. It behooves you to become a member at least just for 1 month, just to get the discount on the shirt or two or whatever you buy, because it's worth it. You'll end up coming out ahead in terms of how much the membership costs. And again, we apologize for how expensive these things are. This is not like, you know, I'll buy a shirt to support the show. You want to support the show? Buy membership. Membership yep. supports the show. Shirts are a fun thing we do together, so we have cool, nerdy podcast shirts. That's what it's for. They're not economical. They're not a big way to support the show, but they are fun, and we do it for the people, and we try to come up with good shirt ideas every year. So, yeah, if you want a discount, become a member, atp.fm/join. There are links to that on the store page as well.
Excellent. And I will do my normal pitch. If you are driving, perhaps signal and then pull over. If you're walking, pull over to the degree one can pull over while walking. But do yourself a favor and write yourself a reminder, send yourself an email, do whatever you need to do. Use the DUE app, use Marco's not yet released reminders app. Do something to remind yourself to make this order, because the sale ends on Sunday, April 26th. And every single time somebody writes, usually me, saying, oh no, I missed it. Don't care. Do it now or leave yourself a reminder. ATP.fm /store.
I've almost missed it several times to buy a show. I remember to do the John Turnus thing now because I had to look up my old order to find his address because apparently wherever I sent it last time worked. So I did that again. But yeah, set yourself a reminder because you will forget. And, you know, we picked the date so we can promote this on three separate shows. But by the time the third show comes around, like maybe you don't download that show immediately or maybe you don't listen to it immediately. And by the time you hear the third one, maybe the sale is over. So yeah, Sunday, April 26th, it ends. Don't put it off. If you want something, get it now.
All right, let's do some follow-up. There was something that was very startling, and perhaps it wasn't new, but it really kind of chapped my behind about the Studio Display XDR. And when I was looking at it when it was first announced, I noticed that the Visa Mount version of it was the same price as the version with the stand, which seems a bit egregious to me. And I popped off about it on Mastodon. I don't know if I'll remember to dig up my particular tweet about it, but it was big, like, what are you going to do about it energy is I think what I said. And that really made me upset. But I mean, I haven't ordered an XDR. I don't think I'm going to. Again, famous last words. But
next
there's
week.
Good news. We'll see what happens. There's good news. The pricing has changed for the Visa Mount version. The version with the stand is still $3,200, but the Visa Mount version is $2,800. So that's now $400 cheaper. And friend of the show, Stephen Robles, got wind of this. In fact, I believe it was him that I heard it from originally, and apparently reached out to Apple via the business chat thing that I always forget exists, you know, in iMessage or whatever, and said, hey, my going to get a refund here? And the Apple person said yes. And he was kind of like, okay, sure. And then sure enough, a little while later, he got a refund for $400 plus tax. So it turns out it's the real deal.
Yeah, that chat person in the chat said basically everybody who purchased it, quote unquote, recently will get a refund. So that's nice. Obviously, you had to have purchased the Visa Mount version to get a refund.
Right.
But this is so weird because Apple doesn't really drop prices, as evidenced by the ProDisplay XDR, the earlier XDR, never changing price for the entire life of the product, despite being, what, 5 or 6 years old, you know, or the trash can or anything like that. But this is so weird because this product just came out, and it was weird that the Visa Mount version was the same price as the one with the stand. But, you know, not that weird because Casey was like, what are you going to do? Apple's going to Apple. But no, maybe they just forgot. Maybe they someone entered it wrong or something. Like, it's so weird. It's not like there was big public outcry from people buying $3,200 monitors that we demand the Visa Mount version be cheaper. Like, it just seems like someone made a mistake or something. So weird.
Yeah, it was very unusual, but I'm glad that Apple is doing the right thing and fixing the issue.
Very out of character. And then the same week that happened, I got an email from Google telling me that they were doing a price drop on my Google One subscription, saving me $50. When does that ever happen? Normally you get emails from like whatever thing you subscribe to and say, as Marco puts, it's always like, what, pricing update?
An update the subject on your subscription.
Like, yeah, it's not, it's ambiguous, but you always know this just means you're going to charge me more money. But no, they sent an email and said, I forget what the subject was, but something like an update to your subscription, like, oh, here we go. Ah, it's $50 cheaper per year. So I don't know what's in the water. But whatever it is, keep drinking it.
Nice. All right. Ryan Himmelwright has a question for John. With the long-anticipated death of the Mac Pro finally here, John has made it clear that he intends to become a Mac Studio user. However, I'm curious to know what he expects his typical upgrade cycle to be once he makes the switch. He has an every-other-year cycle for his iPhone, and I think his iPad criteria tends to be, will this make my bedtime media consumption better? While the Mac Studio is far from Apple's most frequently updated Mac, it's still updated more than Apple's recent proper Tower Macs. As such, John's previous criteria of whatever decade Apple decides to release a new Tower Mac will likely need to be revisited. Thoughts? Also, before you answer that, it just occurred to me an ancillary question. Did you ever use, I'm sure we talked about this, and it's slipping my mind. Did you ever use the Vision Pro in bed, and was that enjoyable, or did you not bother?
Is this the, like, some joke?
You're just going for the double entendres this episode. yes, I did. I talked about it on the show.
Okay, good.
I watch movies in bed with it a couple times. Okay. I prefer the iPad, is what it boils down to. And Ryan basically got it right. Like, the iPad, I am looking like, is this going to make my bedtime watching better? Because that's really all I care about. That's why I got the OLED one. I love it. I still love it. For the Mac Studio, though, my cadence is probably going to be not actually like as you know, more frequent as you would expect it to be. Because, yeah, the Mac Studio is updated frequently. Like, I think they basically do it. I mean, the M3 Ultra one setting aside, I could get like a new one every year, every year and a half if I wanted. The problem is the one I buy is going to be so expensive, especially with all the RAM and SSD price increases because of the stupid 8 terabyte SSD. And once I put all that money in, I'm not going to want to buy another one for a long time. Like, that just tends to be my inclination anyway. I've used all my Macs for a really long time because I tend to buy them stuffed to the gills. And back in the day, I would buy ones that I could upgrade. So I'd use them for a very long time. Like, my Macs was like, you know, my line of Macs is not that well populated. It was the original Macintosh, motherboard updated to a plus, then the SE30, then I went from the SE30 to the Power Mac 6115 or the 6100 series Power Mac, and then from that to a G3 tower, and then from the G3 tower to the original cheese grater, the G5 cheese grater, and then from that to the Intel Mac Pro, and then to the 2019 Mac Pro. That's all the Macs I've ever owned for the life of the Mac. So there's huge gaps in there. Like, going, I mean, I basically went from the SE30 to the blue and white G3 because the 6100 was really my parents' computer. That's a long time. But by the time I switched over, like, my SE30 was maxed out on RAM, had a bunch of external hard drives, had a 24-bit color card and an external Trinitron color monitor. Like, I used them for a long time as I stuffed them to the gills. So with the Mac Studio, assuming I can even afford a stupid 8 terabyte Mac Studio with a reasonable amount of RAM, that's going to be it for me for a long time as my bank account recovers, because that's going to be so... I'm just dreading how expensive it is. Every day there's a story that's like, oh, SSD prices are going up because of AI. I was like, I know. And Apple's prices are always terrible. So it's not the update frequency of the Mac Studio or the Mac Pro or whatever that's stopping me. It's just how much it costs. And so, you know, it's kind of like, as I always say to people, like... maybe wait another year and save up a little more money. That's my mode for everything. It's like, just keep putting a little money aside every year so that 7 years from now you can get the new Mac that you want to get. I don't think that will change much. We'll revisit this when we find out exactly how expensive the Mac Studio I want will be.
Do you want to place a bet as to how much that's going to be?
I don't even want to think about it. This is how much college will cost for Maggie situation. I don't want to. I mean, the only thing I have going for me is like, well, at least I don't need another monitor. You hear that? You hear that? Do not break. Do not break.
Right.
Because I'm reusing the monitor. I'm going to use this monitor for a long time, especially since Apple doesn't make one this big anymore. I just need the little box. I don't need a keyboard. I don't need a mouse. It's going to be rough.
Are the keyboard and mouse USB-A?
For what? The studio?
No, the ones that you're currently using.
No, I'm using the one that came with my Mac Pro.
To what degree?
It connects via Lightning.
Jesus.
To what degree do you think you would max it out? Like, would you get the highest RAM amount offered, which is currently...
Let's make predictions. What will be the highest RAM amount when this thing comes out?
Well, true.
That is not a given. I'm going to feel bad getting a computer with less RAM than my current one, and my current one has 96, but... you know, I don't know what configs they're going to... Honestly, I don't need 96. As I said, when I got my 2019 Mac Pro, 96 gigs made me just not have to think about RAM. I haven't thought about RAM since I bought it. 96 is enough that I never, never, never have to think about RAM. I don't need a full 96. I would be sad, though, to get a 64 because, you know, it's a downgrade after 6 years. So we'll see. And then 8 terabyte, it's my only choice that's bigger than 4, and I need bigger than 4. So, bleh.
Right. So if you... if you want above 128, you have to get the Ultra chip in the current configuration.
I don't want above 128. Like, but I don't need any more than 90. I'd be happy to get 96 again if they offered it.
They do offer 96 with the Ultra. You get just the max chip,
you're looking at the M3 models, though. Who knows what the configs will be like for the M5 ones.
Right, you can do a 128 with the regular max chip in the current configuration. And that would get you with 8 terabytes, 128, max chip with all the cores, that gets you at about $6,000. I'm going to say...
bargain.
Yeah, I'm going to say you're probably going to end up between $6,000 and $7,000 for what you want.
Yeah, that's probably about right. Although, again, I'm going to go for all the discounts I could possibly get through Apple Connections, so hopefully I'll save a little money.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think that if this RAM and SSD stuff continues to go on, there is a distinct possibility you will spend more on the studio than you did on your $95,000 Mac Pro.
When you combine the monitor,
I don't think so.
That's true. I forgot. That's true. All right, let's talk about the Mac Pro and the Mac Studio in a different way. We were talking last week about how much like thermal and power headroom there is in the Mac Studio. And John, it looks like you've done a little bit of science about this.
Yeah, this was, it came up because we were having conversations with our friends and fellow podcast hosts about the discussion of the Mac Pro and the title of the episode, which I believe was something that Casey said was the ability to get hotter, which is a thing that I think Apple could use in its desktop line because the Mac Studio is still pretty small. Like it's a plus size Mac Mini, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not very big. It doesn't have a lot of air moving through it. It's mostly entirely filled with heatsink, but as I think someone pointed out, like the Ultra model of that, if you get the Studio with the Ultra, it comes with a different and better heatsink than the Max version. Like I believe the Ultra comes with like a full copper heatsink inside it, which is another reason it costs more money. And that's because like within those space constraints, yeah, it can handle an Ultra, but you have to upgrade from what I assume is like an aluminum heatsink to a copper one because you're really at the limit of what that case can dissipate. And I was going to look up the numbers and like, oh, this is going to be a pain. I got to find someone's review where they've hooked it up to like a power meter. But no, Apple has official support articles where they will tell you, according to their specs, what the max power dissipation of their computers are. And it's pretty comprehensive. So on this page, we'll link in the show notes, the Mac Studio from 2025 with an M3 Ultra, 32-core CPU, 80-core GPU, 512 gigs RAM, 16-terabyte SSD. Like this, they give you the exact specs. So this is like the current Mac Studio with everything maxed out. I mean, 16-terabyte SSD, how much does that cost? Anyway, that has the max power dissipation or max power draw, whatever they're calling it here, of 270 watts. To compare to my computer, the 2019 Mac Pro, if you got it maxed out, which I did not, with a 2.5 gigahertz 28-core Intel Xeon W, two Radeon Pro Vega 2 Duo MPX modules, so that's four GPUs inside there, 1.5 terabytes of RAM, of course, and also the Afterburner card and a 4-terabyte SSD, that thing does 902 watts. So 270 versus 902. That's how much more headroom Apple has. If Apple had some kind of case that could dissipate more than 270 watts, and I feel like that's probably about the limit of the Studio case, considering they went to a full copper heatsink in there and it has fans already, there's a lot of room. That's almost three times the heat they could be dissipating. So, hey, Apple, if you want to use your new chip technology to make a chip with more transistors that dissipates more than 270 watts for the CPU and GPU combined and everything else inside the Mac Studio, you're going to need a bigger case with better cooling, and I think that's something they should pursue, but Apple seems to disagree. But anyway, how much hotter? The ability to get hotter? Three times hotter is how much hotter they could get.
And for the record, I looked up, there's also on these spec sheets, how many BTUs per hour? 1,007 for the Studio, 3,076 for the Mac Pro.
Yeah, three times the power. They had a case that could dissipate three times the power, but they did not want it anymore. And yeah, the slots are a whole other issue. But yeah, just maybe just like, you know, make the Studio a little bit bigger, give it better airflow, and maybe crank it up to, let's say, 400 watts. Can you imagine? I mean, gaming PCs, like 400 watts is like a mid-range GPU on its own, not even including the whole rest of the computer. So, yeah.
All right. Ben Fearson writes, Frierson, let me try that again. Hello and goodbye, future Marco. All right, Ben Frierson writes, in episode 684, John mentioned that websites will let you pick if you have multiple passkeys. I found this true everywhere except Apple's own websites, which unsurprisingly don't seem to recognize the concept of having multiple Apple IDs. I can speak.
Apple accounts now, Ben.
Oh, that's true. I know this. See, that's why I stumbled. I know this because every time I visit developer.apple.com and try to sign in with my Works developer account using the normal 2FA process, I get interrupted by a prompt to use my primary Apple ID's passkey. This is true, but it's pretty easy to say, I would like to use a different Apple account, please. I don't think
but
I am as upset by this as Ben is.
Well, as far as I know, this gets me every time, because as far as I know, I don't think it's possible to use passkeys for more than one Apple account on a computer.
Oh, sorry. Yeah,
This was discussed when passkeys first rolled out. And I experience this every single freaking day when I have to re-logged into App Store Connect for the 8,000th time. That I always have to do it with password, and it always, you know, makes me do the you know, two-factor thing that Apple thinks. So here's the deal. What I was told back when this first rolled out is that Apple is aware this is an issue, but this is not an issue that the passkey team can solve. It is basically whoever controls, like, the developer websites. Because Apple's Apple ID login, as should be obvious to anyone who has ever used it, first of all, it predates passkeys. And second of all, it doesn't work like normal web things do. Like, you can have a two-factor code. You could have had it in Google Authenticator or any of those other apps. Now Apple has first-party two-factor codes where it's you enter the six digits. You know the whole deal with that. That's not how Apple IDs work. What happens with Apple IDs is you get a whole separate, different, special, custom thing that brings up the map and shows you another thing with six digits on it. That's different. It has been its own thing, its own login process for, you know, presumably for added security for ages. And it seems like now that we have a solution that could, like, you know, modernize, like, you know, stop using that old thing that you were using, start using this new thing, they haven't gotten around to it. And so when you log into your Apple ID on Apple's developer websites, you have to use the Apple ID that you are logged into the Mac as if you want to use passkeys. There is no way, and this has been true from the day Apple rolled out passkeys, there is no way to log into, let's say, App Store Connect with a different Apple ID than the one you're logged into. You can try the passkey login, and it will prompt you, but it will always try to make you use the passkey for the Apple ID that you're logged into. And that's because Apple does its weird own thing with Apple IDs. And every year, I hope this will be the year they'll fix their stuff. And it's been, I don't know, 2-3 years now, and they still haven't. So, yeah, Ben, you're right. That's Apple's fault. It is not the passkey team's fault. It is the team who controls Apple ID login and or the developer websites that is making all our lives miserable. And it's also them that's making me get logged out of App Store Connect every 10 minutes.
All right. Harley Charlton over at Mac Rumors writes, the Office of Financial Sanctions implementation in the UK, in the Republic of Ireland. My bad. That's going to get me in trouble. Let me just reboot that again.
Good call.
All right. So with regard to Russian sanctions and things of that nature, this is a post from Hartley Charlton at Mac Rumors. The Office of Financial Sanctions Implementation said that Apple Distribution International Limited, or ADI, which is the Republic of Ireland-based entity Apple uses to pay App Store developers, made two payments totaling £635,000 to a Russian video streaming platform in June and July of 2022, at a time when they were subject to UK sanctions following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. ADI voluntarily disclosed the payments to OFSI, and the agency confirmed that no breach had been attributed to Apple Inc. itself, only the subsidiary. OFSI said Apple had relied on corporate affiliates to handle payment processing, sanction screening, and due diligence, but that companies are ultimately responsible for ensuring their own compliance with financial sanctions rules.
This came up because we talked about Ubiquiti and things getting to Russians. We said, like, it doesn't really matter whether, you know, it wasn't us, it was like our subsidiary or a third party or whatever. Ultimately, you're responsible. And as soon as that episode, the story came out about Apple getting fined for exactly the same thing. And yes, they voluntarily disclosed it, because if they didn't voluntarily disclose, they would be fined even more. But that's the law. The law is, you know, as Marco would say, it may not be your fault, but it is, in fact, your problem. Pay $500,000.
Indeed. All right. I wanted to quickly point out, listener Naaman Goel, I'm so sorry if I pronounced that wrong, has created retinadisplays.com, which is a very useful resource to figure out what your options are if you want a retina style display. And there are a lot of displays on here. I haven't, like, personally vetted any of these or anything like that, but in principle, the couple that I looked at sounded right and seemed reasonable to me. So this, as Merlin would say, gets my official okie-dokie. So good stuff.
Yeah, we still haven't, all the monitors that were announced at CES still aren't out yet, because it basically takes the entire year for that to happen, or for you to give up on the ones that really aren't going to ship. But this website, in the meantime, is great. You can filter based on size, technology, if you care about that, whether or not it is shipping, whether or not it is discontinued. It keeps getting better all the time. So kudos to Naaman about this website. It's very handy.
Yep. All right, let's talk about color spaces and CIE 1931 and Apple's 2026 CMFs. We talked about this, I don't know, like a month and a half ago. And I think I had theorized that 1931 was the time in which the CIE spec was created. And I think there was some dubiousness amongst us about that, including from me. But many people wrote in to say, yo, that's right. It was in 1931 that the CIE 1931 color space was created. And then Eric Portis had a lot of really, really great feedback. Eric writes, the CIE 1931 color matching functions are not just a monitor calibration standard. They are the foundation of the modern science of human color perception. There are three functions, and I wrote about the three-dimensional color space they create. As an aside, hi, this is Casey. I have never freaking understood color spaces. Maybe that makes me a terrible developer or an idiot, or maybe both. I don't know. But I've never understood it, and Eric's post about it is very, very good. And we're going to talk about another post here in a second, but I really like Derek's post. And if you have any interest in this or want to learn more, I really suggest it. So that's Eric's post, which we'll link in the show notes. And then Bartosz Szymanowski. I hope I got that somewhat close.
Probably
to
Bartosz.
Right. But Bartosz, I think you're right.
I'm gonna give that a better. Hold on, let me check the spelling because I've known some Polish people. I bet it's Bartosz Szymanowski, probably.
All right, we'll go with that. Thank you, Marco, for saving me on that one. Anyway, this person has done some phenomenal websites about or pages about different things, like the mechanical watch one. I still think that's one of the coolest things I've ever seen on the web. Like, these are just incredible. And I didn't realize, this was before I started following him, that he did one on color spaces. And I didn't have the chance to read the whole thing before recording. It's quite a bit longer than Eric's, so you need to, like, properly have a sit down and read it. But it's also very, very good. And Eric had pointed to that and said that he also wrote a great article with many cool interactive examples about the CIE 1931 XYZ color space and how it relates to familiar concepts like sRGB and the spectral locus, aka the XY chromaticity diagram that you've probably seen 1,000 times. Eric then continues, the whole deal with Apple's 2026 CMFs, as far as I can tell, is over time, the R, G, and B light sources that drive color displays have gotten narrower in the range of wavelengths they produce. The red, green, and blue light sources used 100 years ago in the experiments that supplied the data for CIE 1931 CMFs emitted broader distributions of wavelengths than modern OLEDs and LCDs. Narrower sources stress, in quotes, color matching functions more, revealing problems.
And by the way, this is a thing that television reviews have really gotten into in the past few years as well, because they would measure the spectral color output of the R, the G, and the B, and whatever is, you know, producing the RGB light. And if you look at what the diagrams look like, what you want to see is big spikes at R, G, and B. But if you look at TV from not too many years ago, even just like a WOLED from LG for like 5 or 6 years ago, it didn't look like spikes at all. You'd get like one pointy spike for the R maybe, and then like the G and the B would just be this big plateau, like a mound. Like you could barely see any humps in it. You're like, really? That's the light that's putting out? Because what you want is pure red at a specific wavelength that you've decided is the reddest red, pure green and pure blue. And then you can combine those in a predictable way. You don't want your green to have a bunch of red and blue and mixed in with it and everything. You want those spikes. That's been one of the advancements of quantum dot OLED TVs. They would show, look how much pointier the spikes are when we went from regular OLED to QD OLED. It's like, wow, that's so much better. But apparently, as these spikes have been getting narrower and narrower, it has been messing with the functions in the CIE standard, because they were built at a time when the R, the G, and the B were much more smeared and spread out. And I'm not sure what he means by stressing them, but maybe it just reveals more problems with the functions and equations that that do the math on color stuff.
Right. By the way, just before we leave the Bartosz Szymanowski area here, I know we kind of already did, but I was too slow. I cannot recommend enough. Casey promoted his stuff. I cannot recommend enough that you go and read any of his blog posts, because So this is the kind of thing, like, the amount of work that he puts into these. Every blog post is like some kind of explainer about usually some kind of sciencey thing. And not only is his knowledge incredibly deep, but you end up learning so much. And they're all filled with these interactive demos and diagrams and like models. And like, it is incredible.
It's more like an application than a post. If you're thinking, it's a bunch of text and pictures, that's not it. These are basically applications.
Yeah, end up learning so much. One of my favorite ones was the bicycle one. It's all about basically the physics of how bikes hold up and work. And oh man, I love Bartosz's stuff. I strongly recommend. Like, it's the kind of thing that the internet. This is the kind of thing that used to exist on the internet. Just something that somebody put a lot of work into and is just putting out there for free, and it's delightful and mind-blowing and amazing. And there's not that much of that on the internet today, at least if there is, it's very hard to find. Bartosz's posts are that. Like, it's exactly what nerds like us love about the internet. Like, we can't believe that he put all this effort into it, and it's amazing. And it just makes you smile from end to end as you play with it. So definitely.
And if you want to compare it, like, speaking of the mechanical watch one, just try, a straight Google search or, like, look on YouTube. You'll find 1,000 YouTube videos explaining how a mechanical watch works. 90% of them will be AI-generated garbage. But I guarantee you none of those videos is as good as his blog post. It's so good. Like, sometimes a video is not the right format for a thing. You could make a really good video about how mechanical watches work, but man, it would be hard to beat his, again, I don't want to call them blog posts, because, like, you get to do stuff in them. You get to, you read, and then it's like, and this is how it works, and you get to, like, interact with the page until you understand it, until you get it, until you see how it works. There's, a bunch of people have done this. He's not the only one. I saw one recently about, what the heck was it? It was something having to do with, like, pixel art or, like, anti-aliasing patterns.
Oh, anyway. Yes, I saw that too, but now I don't think I can put my finger on it. But yes.
But this particular format of, like, text images, but also interactive, like, application-y things that you can use, it aids understanding in a way that even a video can't match.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, for God's sakes, the top of the mechanical watch post, there is an explosion, extrusion, what is the word I'm looking for? One of those things where you can see all the layers. Exploded diagram of a mechanical watch. That's interactive. This watch has got to be rendered in JavaScript or whatever, and you can explode out the watch. It just blows my mind. I cannot believe this is done with web tech. It's so freaking cool.
Yeah, whenever there's a new Bartosz post in my RSS reader, I'll save it for, like, weeks until I have time to, like, really sit and, like, experience it. It's like saving up when, like, there's, like, a new, you know, movie that you want to watch, or, like, like, the saving up for, like, the finale of your TV show so you can really watch it. Like, that's how I treat his blog posts, because they're just so good. And so delightful.
Yeah, and he doesn't post often, but they're all incredible. In fact, he didn't post all of last year, it looks like, which is really unfortunate. But he has a Patreon, which if you're not going to go to atp.fm/join, that's the next best place to go. So you should check that out. I've been a patron for a while now, so you should definitely check it out. Going back to Eric Portis. Sorry, we got sidetracked there.
Sorry, Eric. It's really hard to follow that.
It really is. Problems with the 1931 functions have been known for a while, and the CIE itself updated its color matching functions in 2015, and Eric has provided a link, which we'll put in the show notes. It's impossible to convert from three-dimensional values, RGB or XYZ or XYY or whatever, derived from one set of CMFs to three-dimensional values derived from another set of CMFs, because reducing actual spectral area, a continuous distribution of light across a range of wavelengths, to three values that represent the quote-unquote same color is a lossy operation. Approximately all digital imaging, cameras, displays, content is based on the CIE 1931 CMFs, and approximately nobody uses the CIE 2015 CMFs because there's just no way to convert the 1931-based values to the 2015-based values. Apple had the bright idea to scope their 2026 CMF to be, quote, white point only, quote, and there's another link that we'll put in the show notes. This means that the Apple 2026 CMF calibrated displays can render content encoded with the 1931 functions and shift every pixel's color value by the measured error between 1931 white and the Apple 2026 white, as measured using the actual spectral distributions output by the display. I'm so curious, writes Eric, how Apple's 2026 CMFs differ from the 2015 CIE CMFs, and what experiments or data they use to create them.
Yeah, I think this is such a great explanation, and it ties into the fact that CIE 1931 is literally from 1931. If there are problems with the standard and it's not keeping up with modern technology as our screens get better and everything, why don't we change it? Well, I think that Eric has explained here, like, there's no way to convert from one to the other. So it's kind of like, look, everyone has to kind of agree to move to some new color measurement standard. And even though they made a 2015 one, people couldn't even move to that. So Apple's kind of like, look, we can't just make a new standard and everyone's going to use it. We need to make something that we can convert from the CIE 1931 into this. So they're saying, we'll just pin the white point and move everything else. Like, we're in a bind here because we're using technology and math made in 1931 that is outdated and inadequate for the current problem space of modern monitors, and yet we can't get everybody to just lift up and say, all right, everybody, we're going to start driving on the other side of the road now, or like whatever analogy you want to make. And so that's why we're using a standard from 1931, because apparently getting off of it will require a degree of cooperation across many industries that is seemingly not possible. So yeah, 1931, that's the year.
All right. We had a bunch of follow-up with regard to Long Island and the mainland. Craig Bowers writes, while for all visible purposes, it would appear Long Island is an island, the U.S. Supreme Court has legally classified it as a peninsula and thus an extension of the mainland. Because, of course, the United States
Something
Supreme
I learned
Court
about did. In my Long Island studies class.
I loved this so much because, yeah, apparently the East River kind of sucks.
when it was filled with poop, it was more like a land bridge.
Yeah, so the East River apparently does not really qualify geologically as a river. It's more, I believe it was a tidal inlet or something. And so, therefore, Long Island is not an island according to the U.S. Supreme Court, based on some, you know, debate about, you know, how the states control different parts of it. Therefore, John, I believe I am correct.
Well, it's kind of like when the government declares pizza to be a vegetable for the purposes of school lunches. Like, the government says lots of things.
Fair.
Or, like, I think they did, like, tomato as a vegetable, not a fruit kind of stuff. It's like, okay, but, like, yeah. There is, in fact, water surrounding it, but not the right kind of water. I do wonder, like, you know, we always just look at our current Supreme Court cases and we can transparently see whatever is motivating the decisions. But, like, whatever was in U.S. versus Maine, like, whoever was lobbying who to say, no, it's not an island, it's a peninsula for the purposes of this thing. Yeah, peninsula, sure.
Well, but I think it's pretty clear. I think there's a pretty good history of New York kind of getting what it wants from the Supreme Court, you know,
especially, like, versus Maine,
right? Or, you know, look at, like, the Statue of Liberty debates with New Jersey. Like, you know, there's been a lot over time of, like, New York kind of just taking what it wants. And
problem solved. We will legally declare this not. We will legally declare this not to be reality. Done and done.
Fair enough.
I think it's the same thing with the pizza as a vegetable. That solves a lot of school lunch problems.
Gracious. And then Joel writes, on the discussion in episode 685 about Long Island's location, John and Marco are both right and wrong. Section 11.2 of the New York State Coastal Management Program describes Long Island as distinct from the mainland and from Manhattan, which is geographically an island, but geologically part of the continental U.S. Quote, Long Island is a detached segment of the Atlantic coastal plain, separated from the mainland on the north by Long Island Sound and from Manhattan on the west by the narrow East River.
The narrow East River.
The Atlantic Ocean completes the island's saltwater encirclement, quote. Then back to Joel. Interestingly, section 2-5 of the CMP also references the mainland of Long Island in a few places, two of which are here. Quote, the most extensive beaches in the state's coastal area are found on the barrier islands and mainland of Long Island, particularly along its south shore. And then the second instance, barrier islands earn their name in this way by protecting the waters of the inland bays and the shoreline of the mainland.
So it seems like mainland is used in lots of official government documents to refer to Long Island.
The government says lots of things, but I will point out that, Casey, did you copy and paste these things from the email, like their direct quotes, the little passages?
Sure, I sure thought I did, yeah.
Yeah, so the part with the whole saying, you know, that Long Island is a detached segment, blah, 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 separated from the mainland of north of Long Island, right? If you notice in that passage, it says separated from the mainland on the north by Long Island Sound, blah, blah, blah. But then in the other two passages where it says, found on the barrier islands and the mainland of Long Island, mainland has scare quotes around it in both instances. Separated from the mainland of Long Island, kind of like when you see, like, fresh vegetables and the fresh is in quotes, you're like, So one instance of this requires no scare quotes because it is accurate and direct. And the other one is like, well, you know, kind of like the mainland of Long Island, quote unquote. Anyway, the government doesn't know anything about this.
Well, it does seem so. This usage reinforces the overwhelming opinion that we got from feedback, and that most, you know, like, dictionaries and things seem to define, which is that mainland is a relative term, and so it seems like
that's not what
the
dictionary says. That's what people want the dictionaries to say, but it's not what they actually say.
It depends on which dictionary. It seems as though mainland refers to basically the larger body of land compared to where you are on a small
you're
body of land.
You're making up your own definition now, but none of the definitions said that.
I don't know. I don't know. I can't say that that is an actual definition, but I think it is a pretty universally
people want it
agreed.
To be. People do. Marco is right that people want it to be completely relative, but then they get angry when I say describe Fire Island as the mainland from a smaller piece of land. They're like, no, that not that. Not the thing that I don't want to be mainland. Only the things that I do want to be.
It does,
and
seem,
then there was, like, an island that's actually called Mainland with a capital M as a proper noun.
Yes, yeah, there's a few things like that, and we did hear from a few people in Hawaii and New Zealand about how the term is used there. Spoiler alert: Hawaii uses mainland to refer to the continental U.S. New Zealand is delightful, and I forget what they said.
New Zealand has a thing. New Zealand actually gets in under the definition, which a lot of people didn't know until I sent the definition back to them, because New Zealand has, you know, as people said, 700 islands. But anyway, it's two big ones. Two big things that make up New Zealand. One is bigger than the other. And that one is referred to as the mainland because according to, I don't have the text in front of me, but most of the definitions say like the larger part of a continent or country. Yeah, New Zealand gets in on a technicality because the larger part of New Zealand is the South Island, and therefore it is the mainland. But unfortunately, that is not the case for Long Island because it is not the larger part of the United States of America.
Well, in conclusion, John, you are still wrong. However, I will offer one more additional side note to the listeners. If you are trying to make an argument to us, sending us the output of an LLM does not make the argument.
I wanted to say this as well, but I didn't want to be a turd about it. But yes,
I'll be the turd.
We've gotten so much people sending us just a transcript or perhaps a link to like a long running conversation with a chatbot. Let me tell you, I do not want to do there's very little that I want to do less than reading someone else's conversation with a fucking chatbot.
Beep.
No, thank you.
Yeah. And look,
I mean, it's kind of like reading their diary. It's like like, I appreciate the sentiment, but, like, it just feels weird reading, like, it's like reading someone else's Google searches. Like, it just, it seems too personal.
Yeah, I think it's, for me, it's like, it's somewhere between Google searches and somebody telling us about their dream. Like, the thing is, and you'll never find somebody on this podcast who likes chatbot LLM results more than me. I use them all the time. But that's not a source, and that's not it isn't an argument winner. It's a summary and sometimes fever dream of facts that may or may not be real and may or may not be helpful. But that is not something that's something that you keep to yourself and you use for your own personal uses. But the output of an LLM is not information to win an argument.
Yeah. All right. Let's do some topics. And I'd like to do a little bit of, I guess, actually follow out. Sorry, upgrade. There was a podcast episode that came out, I want to say sometime last week, and it is entitled, I believe it's Knob Feel, The Greatest Podcast Ad Campaign of All Time. So this is Rob McGinley Myers and Britta Green, and they did this podcast episode from their podcast Phonograph, where they basically talk about the genesis of and kind of the contents of the ATP Cards Against Humanity toaster ads. And John talked to these folks. I talked to these folks. Our good friend Lex Friedman, the good one, not the bad one, talked to these folks. And this podcast episode is really, really good. And I highly suggest you listen to it. I suspect, John, you have some more thoughts, though.
Yeah, when I tweeted about it, I said, like, I don't know if this episode is better if you already know the story of this stuff or if you don't know. But it is very much like I don't know how to describe it, like not This American Life, but that type of like or 99% Invisible or, you know, like like a well-produced, scripted, interestingly put together exploration of a particular weird topic. Only it's about us. It's just so weird to hear a podcast like that about something that you did. Marco's in it as well. You'll hear his voice. So like all three of us are in this podcast. So yeah, even if I feel like if you know everything that they're going to say, it's still just fun to hear because like, isn't it weird that they're talking about this, you know, our weird little podcast on this other really like fancy, well-produced podcast. But if you don't know it, it's fun to see where the story is going. I almost wish the Casey hadn't spoiled what the ad campaign is about. But
sorry.
And check it out. Like, it's fine. But you know, it's not.
Our listeners would know from the title.
Yeah. But like it's a little overblown, like the greatest podcast ad campaign of all time. But it was certainly one of the weirdest, that's for sure. I mean, there have been weirder. And some of the weirder ones are pointed out in the show. I won't spoil what those are as well. But yeah, it is very, very focused on our tiny little circle of the world. And it was a delight to hear and it was a delight to do. So check it out. We will put many links in the show notes because like I don't even know how to link to a podcast anymore. Obviously, we have the Overcast link. But that's not like the real site. That's just
for it. Don't worry about it. I got you back. Well, I've got the official link, and that
you think
has...
it's the Libsyn one is the official
no,
one?
No, it's phonographpodcast.com. I've already
all
got
right.
It
well,
in the show
okay.
Notes.
Well, there's so many links, and there's also the pod.link site, which is one of those sites that's like a landing page that says it has like every podcast player app in the entire world with little icons, and it's like, you know, listen in Overcast, listen in Spotify, listen in YouTube, listen in Apple Podcasts, listen, just going down the whole side of the page. And those sites I just assume will all disappear someday. But anyway, Casey's got you covered. You can find this podcast.
Yeah, it was.
And I also did a little write up on my site about that, which I'll link, which is not too terribly exciting. But I mean, most of what I was saying was how freaking weird and flattering is it that somebody's like history lesson it's about us three dorks. Like, that's really freaking cool and really freaking weird, but yeah. It's good stuff.
It was delightful. It was incredibly, like, you know, heartwarming to listen to. And I listened to it in the car on the way upstate with my family. And so my son
awesome.
Got to hear that. He's like, "That's you." And they're talking about you. And like, it was a very nice experience for
my father's voice coming back to, from the car player. Yeah. It's recorded.
Yeah.
Who knew?
And I think I accidentally blew them off and didn't get interviewed because I blew them off, and that was not my intention. Sorry about that. But thank you for making this podcast. It was delightful.
Yeah, I think when Casey presented the idea, it was like, this person wants to talk about podcast ads. Like, it wasn't clear that this was going to be, because I was just as surprised as anyone. And I said, hey, I'll talk to the person about podcasts. I don't know what they want to talk to me about, but I know about podcast ads a little bit. And it turned out it was good that I did it because I featured in it more than I thought I would.
Yeah, and it was interesting. I think for anybody who is interested in, like, the kind of mechanics behind podcast ads, why everything's moving to DAI now, why, you know, ads like the kind we do seem to be, you know, significantly on the decline and, you know, going extinct. There's a lot of good info there, both from, you know, from us and from the reporters and also from Lex Friedman, and, like, information that, like, you don't usually hear podcasters talk about. Just like how they're sold, what dynamics have gone on behind the scenes. So if you are interested in that whole market, I think there's a lot of interesting information there as well. But it's also just a nice story about our toaster ads.
Yep. All right. Marco did the unthinkable, what was it, a week ago? And you remembered how to post to your blog. I'm shocked that you knew how to do this.
Did he remember, or did he have to figure it out again?
Did AI post to your blog, Marco? Did you
no.
like give the contents of the post to some AI and say, please figure out how to get this on marco.org?
Nope. And I also did not use any AI tools in writing this blog post.
Very well done. All right. So all snark aside, why don't you tell us about this, please?
So everybody was celebrating Apple's 50th anniversary last week. And I do think it's worth pointing out that we didn't do anything on this podcast to celebrate it.
Casey's the one who should feel bad about that, but that is exactly appropriate for me.
Yeah.
He's Mr. Anniversary. I'm Mr. No Anniversary, nothing. Yeah. So I'm on message.
That's true. I think, like, you know, the other podcasts in our kind of nearby podcast neighbor sphere, I think they did a good job covering it, and whatever they did was more of a, like, anniversary celebration than anything we would have done. And so I'm happy to have left that to the other podcasts. They did a very nice job with it. So for me, I was trying to figure out, like, should I post something about Apple's 50th? And I had a little bit of a hard time deciding on an angle because, you know, my feelings about Apple these days are mixed. They do a lot of good and they do a lot of bad. And there's a lot about them that I still love. There's a lot about them that I will always love, and there's a lot about them that I wish they would improve. And we often, on this show, push for that. Like, you know, the reason we push for things to improve when we think they're in a bad spot is that we love these products so much. And if Apple doesn't serve our needs very well, or if they stop serving our needs, the industry has made it pretty clear that they're not really going to pick up the mantle and start serving our needs. there's other things out there that are good, but the way that we love the basic computer, like the Mac, the personal computer, like the way that we love that, and even to some degree the way we love, you know, other general purpose computing devices like iPhones and iPads, other companies are just not going to do what we like in those roles for lots of reasons. Many of them won't. Many of them can't. The market has moved on. These are mature platforms, mature industries. Things are locked down, locked out. So if we want computers to be the kind of thing that we love, the way we've always known them, a lot of that responsibility falls on Apple. With the 50th anniversary, there was a lot of looking backwards at all the good things that Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak and the older, you know, the older company, and then over time, like, you know, the middle of the company's era, all the great things they did. There wasn't a lot about the Tim Cook era in these retrospectives, except for, like, the, you know, Tim Cook scaled everything up. Yeah, that's true. Okay. And I don't have anything really nice to say about the Tim Cook era beyond that. And so I decided I'm not going to address that. But I also, I didn't want to do a retrospective about just, you know, Jobs and Woz, because I have thoughts about that that I'll save for another time. And I also didn't want to just complain about everything in this blog post. And so what I wanted to do here, I decided on this slant, like, we are obviously near the end of the Tim Cook era, and the John Ternus era seems like the most likely thing that's going to follow it. And so I kind of wanted to leave, like, you know, a letter to John Ternus in almost a way of, like, the way that I imagine, like, CEOs and presidents leave letters to their successors. Like, I know that that's actually a thing.
Sit
with presidents.
Sit down and write two letters, right, Casey?
Nope.
Is that, like,
come on,
for your first
Marco?
And last day? I forget the rest of the reference.
I don't remember where this came from. It's probably apocryphal, but or maybe it's a real thing. But anyway, the thing is, I can't even give you the context. So basically, like, a new political leader comes into power and finds two envelopes on his desk. They say, if you get in trouble, open up the first envelope. If you get into trouble again, open up the second one. So he eventually gets into trouble. He opens up the first envelope, and inside is a piece of paper that says, blame everything on me. Basically, blame everything on your predecessor.
Mm-hmm.
And then he does that, and it works. And then time passes, and he gets into trouble again. He opens a second envelope, and it says, sit down and write two letters.
It's very good.
A letter to John Ternus. Is it blame everything on Tim? Is it the first letter?
No, and so what I wanted to do here was basically, like, and in some ways, you know, I'm pretty sure, you know, Apple execs see blog posts. They see press. They see this kind of thing. I was pretty sure,
podcasts.
Probably not, but at least not all of them. But I was pretty sure that if I wrote this way, if it was reasonably short, if it was reasonably constructive, and if I named it a letter to John Ternus, I was pretty sure there was a good chance he'd probably see it at some point.
From his
somehow,
vanity Google searches?
Maybe, or just, who knows? But, like, somehow this would be sent to him by somebody. That, like, that, I think the odds of that, knowing the way Apple's execs, you know, do read a lot of stuff that is, you know, posted by our community, I figured there's a good chance he'd see it. And if not, enough higher ups would see it, it would still do some good. And what I wanted to do was basically just reinforce our principles of, you know, not just what Apple stands for, but what, like, we who are on what we view as the good side of personal computers, like, what we believe in with computers. And, you know, number one is we love computers. Number two is computers, like, serve us, and they enhance our lives. We don't need our computers to, like, you know, control us, restrict us, you know, take advantage of us. And that we are the owner of the computer, and we are the customer being served. We are not the resource being harvested by a barrage of upsells and privacy invasion and tracking and all that other stuff. And I believe Apple best represents those ideals in the computing industry by a mile. They are way ahead of everyone else in all of those ideals. But I also firmly see and believe that while they are ahead of everyone else, their own adherence to those ideals is declining and has declined significantly under the Tim Cook era, as they've pushed into services and upsells. There are promos everywhere. There are ads everywhere. The computer does feel like it is taking control away from its customers and owners and treating us more like resources to be harvested and annoyed. And so I think Apple is they're in a dangerous place here for their ethics, their morals, their quality, and for the things that we care about. So what I was hoping to do with this is keep it very short and sweet and try to advocate for this mindset to not be forgotten. And, you know, a little bit of historical reference to Jobs and Woz, because I do think Jobs and Woz, both in their very different ways, both very much believed in these things and practiced them. you know, wasn't honestly there for that long, but, you know, certainly the Jobs era, Jobs practiced this. Jobs pushed for this. He advocated for this. He cared about this. Tim Cook is a bean counter, doesn't care about this stuff at all, doesn't even know about it, doesn't care at all. I get the impression that John Ternus is a nerd like us, at least in hopefully in the good ways. he seems like a generally better rounded human being than us. But hopefully he does seem like he is the kind of person who would share these ideals, somebody who loves computers and wants to make good computers that serve their customers, not just the vendor or not third parties. I think he seems like, again, I don't know the guy that well at all, but he seems like the kind of person who would believe in this. And so I wanted this to kind of get out there and reinforce these beliefs and bring them into the discussion. And I think it did. I mean, I haven't gotten like a ton of traffic or anything, but like, I think it achieved what I wanted to achieve. And I think the way I wrote it, it is very likely to get to him somehow.
Yeah, when I read this, I was thinking that I in my mind is like a companion to this that I'll never write. Because when I think about stuff like this, and what you said about it actually reminds me a lot of my thoughts and some of my words about the case for a True Mac Pro successor blog post I had all those years ago, especially in terms of like bean counters and car guys type of stuff or whatever. And it's the same type of thing of like, well, mine was more of like a story thing, whatever, just like advocating for, as you said, like our values, what we love about Apple, you know, this is what we want. This is the good stuff. And anything you're doing that is not this is not what we want. Right. And I read this and I'm like, you know, having soaked in the last many years of Tim Cook's leadership, all I can think about is that I feel like what Ternus needs in addition to this is like help with the situation that he's going to find himself in, which is basically there'll be lots of things trying to make it seem like the stuff that Marco is advocating is not the right thing to do. What are those forces? What are the forces that are going to be buffeting whoever leads Apple next, trying to make them not do the stuff that Marco is describing? There are a lot of those forces. They are powerful. They are winning, like internal, external, in the world, within yourself. There's a million reasons why things have been going the way they are at Apple. It's not like, you know, someone is like a mustache twirling villain or whatever. Forces are aligned to make it so that if you are in this position, you are like everything is telling you to do the opposite of what Marco is saying to do. And I feel like what these people need is, I don't know, a thought technology, something to hang on to, something to like some kind of thing they can hang their hat on that will give them enough stamina to withstand the forces that are buffeting them. Jobs had it kind of easy in that, like, he never needed any additional support in that area. First of all, he founded the company. He just felt like he owned it. So it's like, you're not going to tell me what to do with my freaking company. So Ternus doesn't have that. Tim Cook doesn't have that. Jobs did. He was the founder, and he was attitudinal, and so he's got that holding up. And second of all, he was so stubborn and strong-willed and had his own personal beliefs that were sometimes weird or whatever. But in general, like, he didn't have a problem advocating for what he wanted. Like, he just... But that is not a common position that people who are in charge of trillion-dollar companies have, most of them, with the possible exception of Mark Zuckerberg, who is mustache-rolling evil, unfortunately. like, you don't... Like, if you're not the person who feels like, this is literally my company, like, I founded it, it is me, it is mine, you know, like, if you don't have that, then all the world's forces come down on you, and everybody around you, and the board of directors, and all the other executives, and every shareholder, and you can convince yourself that the customers want this too. They're all making you junk up everything and put in more ads and drive service revenue and cheap out on your products and do all this stuff. And for years, Apple held on to, you know, as much as it could, the thing that made it successful. Everyone else was, you know, making netbooks or doing the financially expedient thing. Apple, under the Jobs 2 era, was doing the opposite of all of that, we are going to do things that nobody else does because they seem too hard or too expensive or too stupid or too niche or too esoteric. And it's just like, nobody cares about this. Don't waste time on that. Don't waste money on it. It's not worth your time. This is why Apple is always doomed. This is why Apple will never succeed, because you're doing stupid stuff that nobody cares about. But if you do that hard enough, it pays off in the long run. And that was, I feel like, has always been the story of Apple success. Doing things that everyone else thinks is a terrible idea and that is better in ways that nobody values. And if you do it hard enough and well enough, it turns out people do value that. It's the argument I always make about, like, I always try to use analogies of, like, if you make an expensive product and it just gains a reputation for durability, that you will have customers forever. You have, like, generational customers, even though everything else in your industry is telling you don't do that. Don't make your stuff high quality. Don't make your luggage, like, indestructible. Like, you know, making some really high quality indestructible luggage that costs five times as much as everyone else's luggage, like, you dummy, you should be selling your luggage at Walmart. That's how you get rich. Why are you doing this? And it's like, well, if we do this for 50 years, we will have such loyal customers because we will gain reputation as the company that makes the luggage that doesn't break. Our zippers don't break. Our things don't break down. Like, even though it costs more, we make it better, or whatever attribute you want to be. Like, and that is so hard to do because, first of all, you got to wait 50 years. And second of all, everything in that industry is telling you, don't do it. Make your things cheaper. Make them, reduce the cost of your materials. Manufacture them wherever it's cheapest, no matter what everyone else says. Make sure it's sold through Walmart. Like, just do all this stuff. And it's so hard for, and I know it seems like, isn't that a far cry from what Apple does today? But, like, with every passing day, every single thing that Apple does, I look at the decisions they're making and saying, you are giving in, you know, inch by inch, to the forces that are trying to tell you to do the expedient thing that everyone else is doing. And service revenue is just a perfect example of that. So anyway, I look at this, I'm thinking Ternus or the next Apple leader needs a really good understanding of the things that are going to be the forces that are already aligned against them. The day one they get in there, so many forces are aligned against them inside the company and outside to make them do the wrong thing and make them think it's the right thing, and then give them some kind of something to hold on to let them fight that. Again, you know, they're not going to have what Steve Jobs had, is like, oh, well, this is my company and I own it and I do what I want and I also have really good taste, right? They're not going to have that. Maybe they don't even have good taste, but they need something. They need, I don't know, something to hang on to. Some movie I was watching recently, or I don't remember what it was, but saying, like, how do you get your motivation? It's like, I don't find a reason to do this. I find someone to do it for. Like, whatever makes it work, whatever will give you the strength to make different decisions when everything in your world says that you should not. That is the only thing that can continue to allow Apple to be what it is. And Apple's got more of that than any other company, to Marco's point. Like, they've got more of it than anybody else. Like, I'm not saying, though, Apple's just the same as Dell. They're not, okay? But it's the trend line that we don't like. And so from the outside, everything still seems like it's mostly okay, but the trend lines are all going in the wrong direction. Mildly, but they're all going in the wrong direction. Luckily, Apple started out way far above everybody and everything, but yeah, that's, like, this letter is one thing, and then I feel like, and you're going to read this letter and you're going to be like, John Ternus is like nodding his head going, yeah, no, I believe all that. That's great. Thumbs up. I agree with you, Marco. I'm going to do all that. But then you're going to get into the job and you're not. You're not going to do it. You're going to continue to do what Tim did. And everyone's going to tell you you're doing a great job when you do that. And that's where things go wrong. So, yeah, I don't know what the solution is, but Ternus doesn't listen to podcasts, so this is not going to help him.
Well, maybe he'll get your T-shirt and then be like, you know what? I wonder about this John Siracusa fellow.
No, I just want him to feel sad for 1.5 seconds. And that's it.
No, it was a good post, Marco. And, you know, I understand for a million different reasons why you don't really blog anymore. But I do miss the Marco that was at maybe not a prolific blogger, because I know that was a lot and it took a lot and blah, blah, blah. But I miss the at least periodic blogger. And thanks. I hope you consider doing it some more.
This is kind of like the speaking of your efficiency minded, or maybe pragmatic. It's like Marco knows he's not going to shout Apple into doing what he wants, but he's like, maybe if I just write a succinct summary of the values that I think Apple should pursue and present it pleasantly, here it is. And I'm always thinking, that's not going to work. They need tools. They're going to be buffeted by forces in every direction. They're going to agree with you tacitly, but then they're just going to put more ads in things.
I mean, this is the best tool that we have. You know, we know Apple is a gigantic company with gigantic forces acting upon them from everywhere in the world. People like us don't have a lot of influence on that, but we have a little tiny bit. And this is, you know, I think over the years I have developed a pretty good sense of like how and when to exercise this little tiny bit of power that I do sometimes have. And it doesn't, I'm not expecting to move the needle in a noticeable way, but maybe in a very, very tiny way. Maybe this plants or reinforces some idea in some heads, and maybe it makes it 1% more likely to do the right thing sometime. And that's worth it to me.
It's almost like parenting in that regard.
Yeah, right.
you have a tiny bit of power, and you have to pick and choose when you're going to use it, and don't have too great expectations about how much it's actually going to do. But if you can make a 1% change, just declare victory.
Exactly.
All right. We're an hour and a half in. What do you want to do? I don't think we want to go into Apple Maps right now. Personally, we can do some Ask ATP. I'm personally inclined to say this.
A couple of questions are. What do we have in here?
I'm leaning toward just saying the hell with it. Let's just go ahead and actually the first one we might be able to cover. I presume.
Hang on, let me look at what it is. I put the wrong the disclosure.
Data center.
Oh, there, you already turned it down. There we go.
Data center versus home stuff.
That seems long.
Does it? I mean, that's fine. I, like I said, I'm happy to just hop right into post show.
Well, we're only
I'd
like
either hop into post show or do the second one, because I feel like the second one is a pretty succinct technical thing.
Marco seems unimpressed.
No, I'm
because the first one is definitely long. Like I almost think we should hoist that up into like follow up next week or something.
No, it's I think it's a good question, but we can do the second one this week. The only thing is which after show are we going with? If we're going with mine, which is a little bit longer, or we could do both.
My personal opinion is let's just do both after shows and kill it here, but I'm happy to do that Ask ATP.
We can't do two after shows. It's too much. The two of you will go on forever. One after show.
All right. Well, how about we'll see how long this next topic goes, and how about I'm looking at an hour 32 on my clock. On
well, it's 1:22 since we actually started the show.
Yeah, well, right, I can do this the second question pretty quick because it's
yeah, let's do that.
It's just straightforward.
All right, we'll do the second question, then we'll move into I guess Marco's after show.
All right,
let's do just a touch of Ask ATP. Johnny Decibel. I that sounded like it had a B in it. Let me reboot that. Hi, and goodbye.
Johnny's very loud.
My goodness. All right, let me try that all again. Let's do some Ask ATP. We're going to do just a touch tonight. And Johnny Decibel Noble writes, during the recent Mac Pro discussion in episode 685, there was talk of RAM prices and how they're affecting the availability of certain configurations of the Mac Studio. I'm confused. Memory is unified. The memory in these chips is unified. It's not like Apple's buying DRAM transistors in the open market, are they? My mental model is that some giant machine in Taiwan is given a sheet of silicon and out the other end pops an M5 with 128 gigs of RAM. It's not like the RAM is bought in, cut up, and fed into the machine and soldered onto that chip, is it? I don't understand how the global shortage of RAM affects the production of the M-series chips. I don't understand what effect it has on Apple at all. Nothing's changed inside those giant ASML machines in Taiwan. It doesn't care about global DRAM pricing. I'd love to know where my thinking is wrong.
Everywhere.
Where did Johnny get this wrong?
I already replied on Mastodon to this, but I think this was a good topic because I do wonder how many people also have the same incorrect idea about what unified memory means. It's another one of those terms, kind of like the Mac Pro bereave shirt, where you kind of have to know about the shirt and stuff that came before it to make sense of the bereave thing. Unified memory is like that. So the quick answer to the question is, next to the SoCs, the TSMC prints in your Mac, you will see a bunch of little RAM chips that Apple buys from the same RAM vendors that everybody else buys their RAM from, SK Hynix, Micron, Samsung. Yeah, Apple buys RAM chips from the three companies in the world or whatever it is that make 90% of the world's RAM, and that's why the prices affect them. So that's the quick answer to the question is, yes, they do buy RAM chips. The RAM is not you know, printed on the SOC, which is a thing you can do. There is SRAM on there and stuff for the caches, and there was EDRAM on like the GameCube, I believe, and like but whatever. When you buy a Mac, there are RAM chips next to the SOC. You can see them when you look at the pictures of like a logic board or whatever. But now, why is it called unified? What's the confusion here with the unified memory? What is unified about it? And it has nothing to do with where the transistors that make up the RAM are, although they are very close to the SOC. Because again, if you see like an M2, I sent a picture of an M2 chip. It looks like a little square that says M2, but like 3/4 of the square is the M2 SOC, and then 1/4 of it is 2 RAM chips, and they're just they're like touching it. They're so close to it. They're right there, and this they are soldered down next to it, but they're just plain old RAM chips. But that's not what makes it unified. What makes it unified is that in the olden days, when you made a computer, you had memory or, you know, RAM or DRAM that was in, you know, SIMs or DIMMs or whatever, that the CPU would read, and that was your computer's memory. You got a computer with, you know, 1 megabyte of memory or whatever. But then if you had a video card in that computer, 3D, 2D, any kind of video card, sometimes the video card would have its own memory just for the video card, and that was called VRAM for video RAM. And the video RAM would be used like in a 3D card. It would store textures and geometry, and the video RAM, especially on fancier, yes, the, you know, fancier 3D graphics cards, would have huge bandwidth to the GPU that is on the video card, like just really, really wide buses. They were optimized for moving huge amounts of data into and out of the GPU. And how did that data get into VRAM? Well, the computer would ship it over, probably out of its regular RAM, and it would say, here, video card, you're going to need these textures and this geometry to do your work. Would send it over the bus, PCI bus or whatever, AGP bus, whatever bus was the bus of the day, and it would go into VRAM, and the GPU would read and write to VRAM and do all of its stuff. So you had these two pools of memory, regular RAM that the CPU used, and then VRAM that the GPU used. Unified memory means not having a separate pool of VRAM and regular RAM. Macs in the Apple Silicon age have one pool of RAM that is used by the GPU as its quote-unquote VRAM and by the CPU as its regular memory. And it's any part of the RAM can be used by either one. And they both have a really fast, really high bandwidth connection to that RAM. That's how it works, right? If it was just like, have a GPU and a CPU and just one pool of RAM, that one pool of RAM would be too slow and too low bandwidth. That's why they had VRAM, special VRAM with really high bandwidth to the GPU. But what Apple did is they said, we're going to take our RAM and we're going to make it a huge, wide, fast, low latency bus and solder the chips right next to the SOC. And now that pool of memory can be used by both. And this is one of the reasons why the early days of people saying like, oh, it's okay for a Mac, Apple Silicon Mac, to have a smaller amount of RAM because it has unified memory and that makes it use less RAM. The opposite is true. Back in the day, if you had like, you know, 1 gigabyte of regular RAM and 512 megabytes of VRAM, you had a total of 1.5 gigabytes of RAM in that machine. 500 gigs for the video card and 500 megs of video card and 1 gig for the RAM, right? If you unified that, you'd want it to be combined. You say, okay, well, I'm just going to throw away the VRAM and leaving you with just the 1 gig. Now you have less RAM. So it seems like you have less memory. It's like, now I have the GPU fighting with the CPU for who's going to get to use what part of the one single pool of RAM. And in Apple's case, that one single pool of RAM isn't any bigger. So yeah, it seems like you're using wasting more memory unless you always have the same amount you have. Even today, if you buy a gaming PC, you can get a gaming PC with 16 gigs of RAM, and you can get a video card with, like, I don't know, like 8 gigs of VRAM in it. That's still, to this day, how gaming PCs work. They have dedicated video memory on your NVIDIA card that's just for the GPU, and then they have dedicated RAM that's for the CPU. But that's not how Apple things work. And believe me, Apple does not take a 16-gig computer and then take the 8 gigs from the video card and combine them. No, you just get the 16, or 8 in the case of the Neo. So, again, the way they make this work is because the RAM is very fast. We always talk about those memory bandwidth figures that we give. Very fast, very high bandwidth, very low latency. And it is equally fast when the CPU is using it or the GPU is using it. And the CPU and the GPU are in the same SOC, even if they're not on the same die as they are in the M5 Pro and M5 Max. So anyway, that's what's unified about it. It has unified VRAM and regular RAM into a single pool of RAM, but that single pool of RAM is on RAM chips made by the same RAM manufacturers to make everybody else's RAM chips, and that's why I'm going to pay way too much money for my Mac Studio.
Job done.
All right. Thank you to our sponsors this week, Squarespace and Delete Me. And thanks to our members who support us directly, you can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. Every single episode has about 20 minutes maybe of extra content, one new topic that we couldn't fit in the main show. That's Overtime. This week in Overtime, we're going to be talking about the Claude code leak and how Claude actually works. That'll be really interesting, so join to hear that, atp.fm/join. Thank you so much for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right, Marco, you seem to have some sort of watch-related update. You haven't gone on your great saunter yet, but there's been developments.
So a few weeks ago, I did an after show where I tried a Garmin smartwatch or sport watch, whatever they're called, a Garmin watch instead of an Apple Watch. And my conclusion was basically, I see why other people might want something like this, but I don't want something like this. And it seems like it is a very bad smartwatch in order to be a pretty possibly good sport or activity watch. And I got a lot of feedback about that. And I think I wasn't happy with how I tried it. I wanted to give it a better shot because one of the things I said in the episode was I figured out pretty quickly that I had not really gotten the right one. I had gotten one of the smaller models, like a smaller, simpler model, and Garmin has 1,000 models of their smartwatches. And I really did not. I realized pretty quickly, like, this is not the one that I would get if I was keeping it. But I decided not to keep it and I returned it. But in response to people making very good points, I'm like, I should have given that another try or a better try. So this time, I decided, you know what? I'm actually going to try again. But I'm going to get something that I'm pretty sure I will have a better experience with. And that was not a Garmin watch. It was a Suunto watch. So I heard lots of good things about this brand, Suunto. I think that's how it's pronounced. I forgot to look it up. Sorry. So Suunto makes similar looking watches to Garmin's, like sport watches that are designed for super long battery life, endurance and really strong conditions that maybe you wouldn't want to bring something like an Apple Watch. And they seem very well regarded. In particular, I know our friend underscore David Smith told me that I should probably look at them, and it seems like they have a lot of fans. And so I was looking at their offerings the first time when I ended up with the Garmin. And I couldn't quite decide what to get, and I went with Garmin. But this time I tried the Suunto Race S. What's different about – what I liked about the Race S over the other models is that part of what I wanted was a good offline maps situation. And in Garmin's models, to get offline maps, you have to get a pretty large watch. And in the Suunto lineup, you don't. You can get them in much smaller models. What I went with was the Suunto Race S Titanium model. This is, in most ways, identical to the regular Race S. It costs $100 more and a titanium case. And one of the big advantages of that is it's very much lighter weight compared to the regular one.
Did you get graphite or canary?
It's gray.
No, they're both gray.
Well, they're all
dark gray. Dark gray or slightly less dark gray.
I believe, I got the dark one. So, but I ended up buying, they have an orange strap version that I just bought the strap separately on Amazon for, I think, $50. So here's my impressions of the Suunto Race S. Now, as for context, I took another very long walk a few days ago on Saturday. And I was wearing both the Suunto and the Apple Watch. Here, I will paste this picture for you guys in the Slack. If Slack ever does. Okay. having both the Suunto and the Apple Watch Ultra.
Do the underscore pose.
I was going to say, the prototypical underscore pose.
I was definitely doing my best underscore impression. No, I mean, who can do that? I can't totally rip him off. You know, identity theft is not a joke.
You should be wearing way more watches.
Yeah, I know, right? So anyway, I did this long walk. I did 23 miles, one arm with the Apple Watch Ultra and the other arm with the Suunto Race S.
How long did that take, just ballpark?
About 8.5 hours, 8:44.
That's a long time.
Yeah, there were a couple of breaks in the middle, you know, like 10, 15-minute breaks. But yeah, so 8:44 rough, it was a total time, 23-ish miles. And I've also been using the Suunto Race S for my regular three times a week workouts. These are kind of like, you know, mixed full body, you know, some weightlifting, some Pilates style stuff, some, you know, training kind of stuff, just kind of mixed workouts with the trainer that we do all sorts of stuff on mats and with dumbbells and stuff like that. My impressions also are, I need to clarify that this time, again, my goal here was, let me give myself the highest chance of liking this that I can. I decided not to have it forward notifications from my phone. So it is just a sport and activity watch. It does not try to be a smartwatch, because what I have learned is, you know, I learned from the Garmin experiment, and the Suunto is no different in this way, the abilities of non-Apple Watch watches with iPhones are pretty limited in terms of notifications, and, you know, there's no Siri access and stuff like that. And so I'm like, you know what, just to maximize my chance of liking this, let me try using it for what it really is and not try to make it a smartwatch that it really isn't. So first impressions. It is so light compared to the Apple Watches. It is now, and this is like, you know, the Race S is their, I believe, their second smallest model. But for, you know, this is a category of very large devices, generally speaking. So their second smallest model is still substantial in size. Like, I would say it is similar in overall size to kind of between the Apple Watch Series 46 line and the Apple Watch Ultra. So it's like right between those two, I think, in terms of like how big it generally looks on your wrist. But compared to both of those, it feels so light. The Apple Watch Ultra feels like a brick by comparison. Also, the Suunto straps, way nicer than the Garmin strap that I had. Now, again, Garmin has a very big product lineup. Maybe the one I had was one of the bad ones. Who knows? The Suunto strap, very nice. Silicone, you know, it's nice and flexible. It's light. I think it looks pretty good, you know, for what it is. Much, much nicer straps on the Suunto. Also, keep in mind, as I'm comparing this, I'm comparing it to the Apple Watch Ultra, but the Suunto is only $300 in steel, $400 in titanium. The Apple Watch Ultra is $800. So this is half the price, or less if you get the slightly heavier model. And it is, I forgot to weigh my Apple Watch Ultra, but it feels like it's half the weight also. So it is significantly lighter, but it still offers similar battery life in terms of, like, if you're doing a long workout, it, like, if you need, like, long workout time, if you're going to be on like a 12-hour hike or whatever, the battery life between this smaller Suunto and the biggest Apple Watch is in the ballpark of each other. They're pretty similar. And if you want even more, you can get the bigger models, but I didn't want to do that. So anyway, the screen, nice and bright, totally serves its purpose. I will say the always-on screen kind of sucks. But it's mostly, it sucks if you try to use it as a smartwatch, which when I tried the Garmin, I was like, let me try to make this a smartwatch. With this, I'm like, you know what? These suck as smartwatches. Let me try to make it a sports watch. So I'm not wearing it all the time. I'm wearing my Apple Watch most of the time. And when I am doing an activity that requires like sports tracking, I put this on, either instead of or in addition to the Apple Watch. And so by using it that way, a lot of the other decisions they have kind of make more sense. So the always-on screen, when you're in an active workout, it shows the workout data. Always on. And you can turn it off to extend battery life further. But you know, shows the workout data exactly as you expect. It dims it, you know, if it's not like active, but otherwise it's there. When you're not in a workout, this has a customizable watch face, just like every other, you know, smart-ish watch. You can customize. They have complications. They have a few different faces you can pick. There's like a face store you can go into on their app. By the way, the app and the setup process, way nicer than Garmin's. Garmin's apps, plural, and setup process are obviously like burdened by lots of legacy and complexity and kind of just scope creep, I think, over time. Suunto, I believe, is a significantly younger brand. They have a lot less crap in them. They're much more like simple. There's a lot less that's like trying to get you to upsell to other things. It's just like a nice, simple, and in my opinion, better graphically designed platform. Everything about it was way nicer than the Garmin experience for me, including the experience of actually navigating the watch. Maybe if I had more time with the Garmin, maybe I would have gotten faster navigating it. But the Suunto seems like it just makes a little bit more intuitive sense. Like there's a couple of buttons to learn, a couple of like standards, but for the most part, I learned it a lot faster. And again, I think the general graphical style of Suunto is nicer. And frankly, I think their hardware also looks nicer. I mentioned already the straps look and feel and work better than the Garmin that I had. But also just like the watch case, I think like it's a little bit more tasteful looking. The Garmins have like a certain look of like extreme sport activity, you know, and they kind of use color in weird ways. And I think Suunto just has a better style overall. Then it came time to charge it. The Suunto charger is now. I should also point out their models have different chargers, and so this one I think is one of the older ones because the Race S is like a couple of years old, and the Race 2 is the newer model, but it's only the big size so far. This charger is USB-A only.
Ooh.
There appear not to exist any USB-C options, and because they're not all the same, that introduces some interesting complexities. So, for instance, it's a USB-A charger. If I want more than one cable, I'm going to have to buy more, and you know, keep them wherever I might be. You know, maybe put one in the backpack. You know, like if I want to have it like charge like on my bedside table or whatever, like. You quickly realize that the Apple Watch, by being the dominant platform, it has certain kind of built-in advantages. And one of them is that there's lots of accessories out there made for Apple Watches because Apple sells tons of Apple Watches and has for a decade, and they've always used the same charger. So people have had time to make third-party cables, third-party docks, third-party battery packs that all can charge Apple Watches directly, like, on them. And in this ecosystem, that just doesn't exist. You know, the Suunto ecosystem is way smaller and way younger, and because they use different chargers for different models, like, if you say, you know, if you brought this on a trip somewhere, and if you need to charge it. Now, it does have a very good battery life in standby mode of, like, if you're just using it as a watch, it'll last many, many days. But if you were like in a bind and needed a charger for this, if you were wearing an Apple Watch, you could go to any drugstore, any like airport kiosk or whatever, and you can get an Apple Watch cable to charge your watch. If you have something like this, good luck. You probably won't be able to find what you're looking for without like, you know, going to, you know, ordering something online and having it delivered to your hotel, maybe if you're lucky, you know. So
does this charge the same way as the Apple Watch does, like inductive, like a pad or a thing that like
It's not inductive. There's contacts on the back. Yeah, here, I just pulled it up. Yeah, so
there's not a port, but it's just like
There is a magnetically attaching disc that attached to a USB cable. And but it's a proprietary charging system that uses two pins on the back.
Interesting. I wonder if you could just like buy any charger at a gas station and rip open the wires and just take the positive and negative and hold them to the two contacts on the bottom.
Yeah,
of the
watch. Just apply 5 volts across these terminals and hope for the best.
Yeah, I mean, like as I was asking whether it's inductive, like that you needed some kind of coil that exactly matches and aligned to the thing. But if it's two like pin contacts, that's real old school.
Yeah, I mean, maybe that would work. I don't know. But anyway, so it is like again, it adds to the friction. If you wanted to make one of these your daily driver, it just adds to the friction that it's not a standard charger. And unlike the Apple Watch, which is also like not a standard charger, so to speak, but like it also is not dominant in the world and hasn't been there for long. And so odds are you won't be able to charge it with in any other way other than one of its official cables or a clone from Amazon that has all the same problems that the official ones do, all the same limitations. So anyway, so the charging situation is bleak, but the battery life is so good that like you can, if you're just like keeping it around for doing occasional workouts while you're on a trip, you wouldn't really need to charge it if you know, unless your trip is longer than a week or two maybe. But that is a downside. All right. As for other physical characteristics, the speaker on the watch is just like beeps. It's like a cheap digital watch, like that it can do like, you know, it can play different tones of beeps, but it doesn't appear to be like a real like PCM speaker, which is interesting. It's like using like back, John wouldn't know this, but Casey, you would.
I know about PC sound. I used to laugh about it.
Yeah, like PC sound. Like gracious. If you just had the PC speaker, you didn't have a Sound Blaster, mm-hmm. and it's that. It's that kind of sound.
You could get the Atari Lynx voice, not the Atari Lynx, the Lynx golf game voice.
I bet the
Suunto watch can make that noise.
Oh, it can make some noises. All right. Yeah. So that's interesting. But what I learned using this thing is that generally speaking, as a computing device, it is very primitive compared to the Apple Watch. And you see that in a few different ways. So one of them is, yeah, like the PC speaker kind of speaker. Also, the app seems, or the watch seems to have not really any concept of like multitasking, so to speak, in a practical way. So like, for instance, the app, the watch will only sync to its app if the watch is on its home screen, not in an app. And the Suunto app on your phone will yell at you, like, put the watch back on the home screen so we can sync data.
Lovely.
Also, there was a point where during my big walk, I wanted to change a setting. I wanted to turn off the always-on screen during the big walk to try to conserve power. And it turned out I didn't need to do that. It had plenty of power. It finished an 8.5-hour walk with 66% battery left. So
goodness.
It was fine. And that's with the always on screen on and with, the
and
heart rate
GPS?
Tracking, heart rate tracking and GPS.
Does this have the fancy GPS that you really, really wanted from the Apple Watch Ultra?
Yes, it does. It has nice. Dual band GPS, L1 and L5. So it's very ultra in a lot of these features. Like it competes directly with the Apple Watch Ultra in a lot of these features. But again, at half or less the price. And much lighter weight, and in some ways even better battery life. Not always, but in some ways. So anyway, the always-on screen, when you're not in a workout, only shows a dumb clock. Like when the Apple Watch is in like power save mode, it only shows the time. If you want to actually see your watch face, you have to like hit a button on the watch, and that will bring up the watch face. And so the value of things like watch faces and complications, I think, is somewhat limited by that. but they're there. The situation with watch faces and complications, again, they exist. They're very limited, very primitive. A lot of things are missing. So like they have built-in weather widgets and stuff that you can put as complications, but there's very few metrics you can measure. Like they're like one of the things I was disappointed by is that there's no UV index. And what I always have on my Apple Watch is temperature, UV index, and timer as my bottom three complications. Because I always want to know that, so I know, like, do I put sunscreen on right now or not? Anyway, so all that stuff is very primitive. And also, so it has this feature where you can download offline maps to it, which is great. It's not super granular. I had to download all of New York to have any of New York. And all of New York is a gig, and it takes a while to send it. It takes, like, an hour to send it over to the watch. So it's a slow process, but it does actually work. Once the map is on there, map navigation works great. You can zoom in and out. It's all that stuff is great. And I needed offline maps for this because this was upstate where there's not very good coverage of any sort. And also, by the way, these watches do not have a cellular option. Garmin does on some of their larger models. As far as I could tell, none of the Suntos do, I don't think. Certainly this one doesn't. So that's another thing. Like, if you want the this watch to have cellular for things like if you wanted to maybe take a run without bringing your phone with you, this isn't going to help you. Similarly, most of these watches don't support like local music playback to Bluetooth headphones. And so some of the newest ones do, many of them don't. So again, like I think the Apple Watch has spoiled us for how good of a computing platform, how good of a smartwatch it is. But again, this is half the price and way lighter and with very good battery life. So I think we can forgive a lot of those things. Okay, I'm almost done here. At some point in the last couple of weeks, there was a software update that just happened automatically. It didn't ask me, it just did it. And when I woke up the next morning, my watch face and complications were blown away, reset to defaults, and my offline maps were deleted.
Oh, brutal.
Before that, the complications on the watch face didn't quite fit the layout of the watch screen. Like, there were some that were like overflowing their bounds. After that, that was fixed. So, okay. It feels like I'm using a beta. Suunto, yes, they are a younger company. It shows. Their software is still a little rough in a lot of those ways. So after that, I reset up my watch face. I downloaded the New York map again and had it sent it over to the watch for over an hour again. But I did get it to work. But having a software update silently wipe out my entire watch face configuration and offline maps was a little disconcerting. All right. As for actually using it during workouts and during the giant walk. So, workouts first. It's really nice during workouts, actually. So, this confirmed, first of all, that I don't need it to be any bigger. One of the problems that I have with the Apple Watch Ultra in my regular workouts is a lot of times we are like, on our hands, on the mat, or I'm lifting a big dumbbell with a workout glove, like a weightlifting glove. And a lot of times it's easy for like my wrist or the edge of the glove to accidentally push buttons on an Apple Watch. And I don't have that problem. It assumes the buttons are a little harder to push, so that's good. And also, that's also why I don't want one that's any bigger than this, because if it becomes bigger, then it starts getting in the way of my wrist movement, like if I flick my wrist up and stuff like that. So I was very happy to have the size that I have for that. And fortunately, I have not needed the – there's never been a moment during this trial so far that I've needed a bigger screen or a bigger battery or anything. So I'm glad I have this smaller one because, again, even smaller. It's not small in absolute terms. It's just smaller than other sports watches of this type. Anyway, during workouts, I like that it's given me – every second it's given me heart rate updates on the screen – always on, all the time. So if I'm feeling like I'm really pushing myself in a workout, I can just quickly glance at the watch and I can see it does this nice like ring around the outside of like heart rate zones, and you can customize those zones, which I found very nice. So I was able to set like, you know, the four or five zones that go around the face of the watch. You know, they're color coded, you know, like, you know, red, yellow, green. And I was able to set like where the boundaries are to match kind of, you know, what I want those to mean. So I can tell, am I pushing myself, you know, as hard as I expect to be or want to be? And I can adjust in response to that. That was very nice. And when doing these workouts, that's when I realized, oh, round is the right shape for fitness watches. I get it now. But I still maintain that round is not the right shape for smartwatches, where you need to be reading text frequently, like from notifications. But now I understand round was nice for a lot of these things. It isn't always ideal, but it was nice for a lot of these things, including that like kind of radial display of the workout. And it the way the screen is designed, and I felt this way about the Garmin too to an extent, although I didn't get too much into customization of the Garmin, but the way the screen is designed, it makes it obvious that like these watches are designed by people for sports and activities. Whereas the Apple Watch, even like Apple's workout app, it's designed by graphic designers to make it look pretty, but a lot of times the functionality is not quite there. Like with Apple's workout app, I often have trouble like distinguishing what the different numbers are. At a quick glance, you have to kind of, oh, wait, that's the time. Oh, okay. Oh, that's not the heart rate. That's the pace, or, you know, whatever it is. Like, it's a little bit, you have to like kind of look a little longer than you maybe should to distinguish, because it's all just like a bunch of left aligned giant numbers. Whereas these watches, the way they design their faces, I think they use the shape better, they use the space better, and they have more differentiation between the metrics they're showing you. So it's easier for you to see at a glance. So that was, I find the Suunto to be very nice during workouts. Also, on the big walk, I found it to be great for kind of just general like motivation, because it had a few different modes you can switch between, about like you could see like how far have you gone, or you could switch it to a countdown to like how far it is back to where you started, or if you load the route onto it, you can see like how far it is to the end of the route. So that was all very nice. I also loved that every mile the Suunto would give me a nice little beep, like doot doot, like a little like encouraging beep. Hey, I did another mile. And I found that to be like a little delightful thing. I would actually look forward to it as I knew I was approaching a mile marker. Like, oh, I can't wait to get my beep, my celebratory beep. That I found delightful. And I also really enjoyed that the Suunto app afterwards, when you're reviewing the data, it has a lot more detail than the Apple Fitness app does for reviewing workout data. And it allowed me to like dive in and see, like, you know, I can customize, I can see different charts and graphs and lay one on top of the other to see different metrics. Like, oh, if I put like elevation over pace, I can see how I slowed down when I was going up the elevation and stuff like that. Or you can see where your brakes were in the pacing and everything. And you could break down like by mile. It didn't matter that I like pushed the lap button accidentally a few times. It also kept an automatic quote lap of each mile I did, so I could go back later and review like speed per mile and, you know, pace and heart rate and all that other stuff. So that was actually really nice. I liked the workout data review in the app. I don't know if it writes to HealthKit. So far it isn't. I don't know if that means it can't, or if I just haven't enabled that yet, or if there's some third-party tool I'd have to use to do that. But right now it is not writing to HealthKit. For my purposes, I don't think I care, but that could be a big deal to a lot of people. But generally speaking, I really enjoyed it on the walk. Again, because it's so light, and it did a perfectly good job of tracking the things I needed to track on that walk, I was really very impressed by it. As a smartwatch, it's terrible. All of these devices are terrible as smartwatches for iPhone users. I mean, maybe it's better on Android, but for iPhone users, I wouldn't recommend anything except an Apple Watch for a smartwatch. If you want general purpose smartwatchiness, you want notifications to pop up on your wrist, maybe you want to have like a nice watch face that has a lot of complications, maybe that tells you useful things throughout the day, you want to see your calendar, you want to, you know, do all that stuff, the Apple Watch is the one you should get. If you want kind of the best generalist, you want maybe music features, you want cellular, for all of those kind of like, if any of those edge case or if any of those use cases are important to you, you want an Apple Watch. If you only want to have one watch in your life, you want an Apple Watch. If you want easy charging on trips, like there's so many things. The Apple Watch is the best answer to so many of those things. If you want Siri, if you want to be able to remotely unlock your Mac or your phone with it, like so many advantages to the Apple Watch. But if you want a watch for workouts and taking on long treks like this or similar kind of extreme, you know, sporting uses, I think the Suunto is better. But that's a huge amount of ifs. And it is a much more primitive device in all those other ways that allows it to be a better sports watch in a lot of ways. Again, it's also half the price and very light. So I'm actually very happy.
Is that weight difference you're feeling, by the way?
8.6 grams?
Yep.
I don't believe that for a second.
I'm looking at Apple's spec page. Now, what it might be factor in is, because I'm assuming these weights on both Apple's page and Suunto's page are just for the watch body. And so maybe the if you're wearing a really heavy, like using like the Link bracelet on the Ultra or something.
Hold on. I will tell you. Hold on. Give me one moment. I'm getting a scale out of my closet.
Yeah. Anyway, the Sundo page says 53 grams, and then the Apple Watch Ultra. This is the Apple Watch Ultra 3, so maybe it's different for the original Ultra. The Ultra 3 is 61.6 for the natural finish and 61.8 for the black. The black weighs a little bit more.
All right. I'm back. So I got my scale here. 1 second.
Unless maybe the Sunto includes its strap. I don't know. It's hard to tell.
All right. The Sunto Race S Titanium with its strap is 53 grams.
Yeah. I guess they're including the strap and Apple's not.
Yeah, so the Apple Watch Ultra without strap is 62. If I toss on here, I mean, I have a couple of straps here. So
60, I think you mean 61.6.
Sure, okay.
That's what Apple's webpage says.
So if I use the Ocean band, their silicone one for the Apple Watch Ultra, the total is 97. If I use the leather loop, which I actually like a lot, the total is 101, 100. So the Apple Watch Ultra is, with a strap, about twice the weight. And you feel it. You definitely.
Yeah, I guess the Sunto one includes the strap in its weight because it includes the strap.
Yeah,
although,
I mean,
no, the Ultra comes with the strap too, doesn't it?
Yeah, so just the Sunto Titanium without the strap, I just took it off, is only 35 grams, and the Ultra is 62. So that's a huge difference, and you really feel it. So anyway, I am going to keep the Sunto. It's not replacing my Apple Watch, but I am going to continue to use it during workouts if I have it. So, like, if I'm on a trip, I'm not going to bring it. You know, there's no reason for me to do that, really. Although it is light and doesn't need a charger for a long time, so maybe. But you know, for my regular workouts, I'm going to keep using it. For the big walk, I'm definitely going to use it. Although I think I'm going to use it and an Apple Watch Ultra. Just to like have multiple tracking things, you know, as backups and things like that. But I'm very glad I tried this again. So thank you everybody who told me that I gave Garmin's kind of a short shrift there. I still don't like Garmin's, but I do like Sunto. So
do they have the Sunto? You took those straps off pretty quick. Do they have like a mechanism like Apple's that like makes the straps come off easy?
No, they have what the rest of the watch world calls quick release spring bars. So it's like it's a regular 22mm spring bar mount on the watch, and the straps are just regular spring. Like you could put these on any watch with a 22mm spring bar setup, but they have these little tabs in the back that you can pull to one side and they pop off, which I think that's what Garmin did, but I forget off the top of my head.
Well, that's very fascinating. I was expecting that you were going to say, oh, I bought the wrong Garmin, and such and such other Garmin is the right answer. But it seems like no, at least as far as you're aware sitting here tonight, it's not the Garmin it's not the particular Garmin that's the problem. It's that you shouldn't have gotten a Garmin at all.
Well, I think, it depends on your use case. So Garmin has a number of significant hardware advantages and maybe software advantages too. I didn't get too far into that. But what I really wanted was something that was small enough that it would not, you know, interfere with my workouts or shirts or things like that. Lightweight was a plus. And I wanted offline map support. Garmin is pretty stingy with which of their models get offline maps. And so the one I got was the Venue 4, which that was the wrong choice for me. I think if I was going to buy a Garmin today, I would probably get the what's their running line? I already forgot. All these names sound the same. Not the Phoenix. The Forerunner. There we go. So the Phoenix 8 is their like flagship kind of everything watch. I would probably look at that, but it's pretty chunky for my taste. The Forerunner line of Garmin looks like maybe a better fit for me, but you have to get the giant one, the 970, to get the offline map support. For reasons I don't understand. I think it's just like market segmentation. But you know, and also keep in mind that model is as much as an Apple Watch Ultra. It's like $750 and up. So again, Sunto has a pretty big price advantage here for, you know, generally similar utility to what I'm looking at here. But Garmin also, you know, Garmin has some watches that have cellular. They have better like music capabilities in many of their models. They have their high end ones even have satellite connectivity, which the Apple Watch Ultra 3 does. Sunto doesn't have anything like that. And Garmin has like different screen technologies. They actually offer a micro LED screen for like $1,600. But you can, if you want, you can buy a Garmin Phoenix 8 like super edition that has a real micro LED screen. That's super
Remember when
bright.
Apple was going to make those for its Apple Watch? Like, they invested in this. They were going to build their own micro LED screens for the Apple Watch, and they, after a couple of years, they said, ah, never mind.
Yeah, right. Well, Garmin did it. Like, you can get a Fenix 8 today. Fenix 8 Pro micro LED. $1,700, excuse me. And only available in 51 millimeter size. So it's huge and very expensive. But they will sell you one if that's what you want. It's like super, super bright. So ultimately, this has taught me that I appreciate this category of watch if I change what I expect it to solve for me, if I change the role that it has in my life, kind of scale back what I want it to be, I appreciate what it is. And it also makes me really appreciate that Apple's done a really good job with the Apple Watch. Like, when you see what else is out there, yeah, I wish Apple would have every advantage that every other watch has. They won't. They can't. So there are certain trade-offs inherent with the decisions they've made. But I will, of course, reiterate that I think watchOS in general is a really under-invested in platform by Apple, and there is so much potential that they just have chosen not to address yet or ever. But the Apple Watch really stands up against its competitors in a lot of ways. Like, if what you want is the best all-arounder, it's not even close. It's definitely the Apple Watch, no question. And you should only be looking at these other categories of watches if you know for sure that the Apple Watch is not satisfactory to you for some reason, and you're willing to give up all those other things to get, you know, to use something else. But these do have a place in the market, and so I'm glad I've gone on this experience to, like, figure that out better and to experience these, to have, you know, maybe a new, better workout watch for myself. And again, for only $300 or $400 for the light one, I think it's a great deal.
All right. Titles.
Oh, fair bit. I saw one go by that I like, to see if I can find it again. Write Two Letters was one that I liked. The Reddest Red I like.
Yeah, I was about to say the Reddest Red is good.
I mean, Saltwater and Circlement's pretty good.
Oh, you're too biased.
Yeah, I kind of like the Write Two Letters because like Marco's letter to Turnus. It's not what it was about, but it's a double meaning. A tiny bit of power I like. Yeah, I'm going for the trying to find a Marco Turnus blog post theme. So Write Two Letters and a Tiny Bit of Power are my favorites.
All right. I like both of those.
I think I like Reddest Red a little bit more, but I can go with those.
Which of those two do you like better, Casey?
51% Write Two Letters, 49% A Tiny Bit of Power.
Well, Write Two Letters it is.
Are you good with that, Marco?
Yeah.
All right.
I like them both equally, so I was unhelpful.
I can just, while I was trying to recall that story, I could just hear Merlin crumbling to dust as I struggle to remember the story while trying to tell it, and as he would say, bullet points. I wish I had remembered it better so I could have actually given an attempt to tell the story, and I did the best I could. Oh, and someone pointed out in the Mastodon, actually, that the thing I was trying to remember, the piece of media that I had seen about finding... instead of finding a reason to do something, find someone to do it for. That was from the movie Project Hail Mary, a rare trip to the theater that I took with the family recently.
Oh, yeah, I haven't seen it yet.
I heard that was very good.
Same.
It's all right. It's all right.
Wow.
You have to go to the theater and see it.
Harsh.
Love endorsement. All right. I believe we're normal time for the foreseeable future. Yes, we will celebrate Tax Day next week. All right. Goodbye, live people. Thank you for being live people.